frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Listening to the Mad Science Show at www.shazizradio.com and over there at People for People Radio and a few others there, affiliated networks. Did want to talk about reinventing the wheel today. Well, sort of. Anyway, if you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html at www.shazizradio.com/superchat.html. And if you want to go over there and join the people at People for People Radio, there is a link. If you scroll down underneath the four chat rooms in the super chat, there is a link for people for people radio. Go over and visit with them and say hi. I got an echo coming back on me. Anyway, so reinventing wheel. I actually posted a video in there. Basically, shows a couple different designs on you know, people that are basically making wheels work better. So when I talk about reinventing the wheel, first I got to give you a definition of what this says on Wikipedia. You know, the actual definition of the phrase reinvent the wheel is waste a great deal of time or effort in creating something that already exists. See, this is the problem with society, is because that's the kind of, you know, terminology that's used to discourage people from, oh no, it's already been done before. Well, maybe it's already been done before, but maybe, just like these folks that take and design all these custom wheels, like instead of having to have shock absorbers, you can actually build that technology right into the wheel itself, just with the understanding of how that wheel actually functions to begin with, and where the weaknesses, flaws, or you know, even its strengths. Basically, taking all the good pieces of every single design out there, and everything that you've learned from that specific design, making it better. So, it's not necessarily a case to reinvent the wheel. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. The wheel was good, even if it was all the way back to when it was made from stone. But, you know, yeah, back then they figured out over time that, yeah, well, this thing right here made from stone's pretty rough ride. I even remember back when I was a kid, they used to have these roller skates that had iron wheels on there. Man, you want to talk about a foot massage, those things will drive you insane riding around on there. And if you hit a little piece of gravel, you'll face plant in the street in a heartbeat. And so they weren't a very good design. But nonetheless...
You skate for 20 minutes and they make your feet itch.
Yeah, they do, man. They vibrate the heck out of your feet from the friction, and they're just a rough ride. But, you know, they even had plastic wheels for little kids out there. Same concept, but just as bad as far as the vibration-wise. And if you hit a tiny little pebble, you got issues. And, you know, then as time passed, they figured out better ways to make and better materials to make skateboard wheels out of and such. But they didn't necessarily reinvent the wheel, as they made it better. And so, you know, when you... get into the alternative energy community and you start trying to, what some people might think is reinvent the wheel, you know, they basically are telling you you're wasting a great deal of time or effort creating something that already exists. So, you know, this whole concept of free energy, it already exists. It has existed. You know, electricity has existed for as long as we can remember, and even prior to when we even knew it was even in existence. What we know is electricity. You know, lightning, static electricity, or thermal electricity, whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, we just figured out fancier ways to harness it. And so, why would I even bring up reinventing the wheel? It's because... when you're looking at all the things that we actually use on a daily basis, you know, all these different transformers and types of materials, and, you know, you're trying to show people, you know, free energy, right? Well, first, before you can show anybody that energy is free, you got to have an understanding of how it's actually functioning to begin with. You know, like the person that went and took the time to do some of these designs on these wheels. You know, they studied that wheel and they're like, you know, if I put this over here, I can actually absorb that shock right there. I don't know if you ever been riding on a bicycle that had bent spokes, but or even a bent rim, but they just don't really roll that well and can be kind of dangerous. But this one particular design that I liked on there has actually had hydraulic shock absorbers on in the actual rim itself, and so gave you a really smooth ride. But nonetheless, that's not exactly what we're here to talk about today, because reinventing the wheel is just kind of like one of those things when people try to tell you you're standing on a soapbox and you're trying to tell people stuff, you know. It's one of those, as far as I'm concerned, it's a degrading insult to intelligence, because you don't have to necessarily reinvent something to make it better. There are companies out there that that's what they specifically do. They don't build things, they build things better. They actually go out and study products that are on the market, and they do whatever they can to not necessarily redesign the entire, re-engineer, reinvent the entire deal, but to take this thing and to make it as best and as efficient as possible. That's what we're talking about with energy today. We're talking about
The Japanese and the Chinese, it's been said that they don't invent anything. All they do is reinvent. And the reason, there's a good reason for that. Because when you join a company, you join a family. And to get fired from them is like you just get excommunicated from your family. And all it takes is one bad idea. So they got to make sure that they start with a good idea and improve it. If they can improve it, then they know it's a good idea. So that's the reason for that. Germans and Italians and stuff like that, now you get a lot of good inventions and you get the German ingenuity. But a lot of the inventions, basically United States and Canada and such as that.
Personally, I think every idea can be improved on. I mean, when we talk about the internal combustion engine, and basically all the measurements and science says that it's only like 30% efficient. And so that leaves a whole lot of room for improvement. If it's only 30% efficient, then that means you've got a lot of improvement you can do on there. Ways to make it run better, ways to make it run cooler, more efficient. That's what the whole key is. See, and in order to finally get to what I guess would be classified as the holy grail of free energy devices, then first you got to have an understanding of the devices that you already got. Why is it that this one isn't good enough, you know? It's not that they're not good enough. I mean, we can still use them. We can still use our transformers and stuff like that, but we're not using them in the most efficient manner, so it costs us more, over time to actually use that the way it stands right now. The wheel works fine, and even wheels from back in the 1800s, they probably still work fine. They did the job that they were intended on doing. However, to make those advancements, you got to allow people to think outside the box and say, well, how far could I take this idea? I mean, maybe there's only so far you could ever take a wheel as far as improving on it, but that one particular tire that I mentioned that had the hydraulic spokes in there that actually had that's the shock absorber portion built into the wheel, made it so that it wasn't even necessary that you had an air in your tire, because it absorbed all the shock that the normal air tire would. And so in the video, the lady's pulling out a nail out of the tire and just get back on the bike and starts riding. There's no flat tires anymore because you just took the reason why you had to have air in the tire away from it, because now all the absorption is actually transferred into the hydraulics portion of there. What do you think, buddy? Did I lose you?
I see these other tires that they got there. It's made out of, it looked like they took the sidewall of a regular car tire and they cut it in these rectangles and then they put them all together. Then I see these plastic, matrix. They carve out holes in it in a certain pattern so it all flexes and actually gives better traction. And they're not going to have a flat.
Yep.
So, flat-free tires.
So, basically, I think that all these systems that we've got right now could be re-engineered or adapted or even used in a different fashion than what we're using them now, and they would still be just as good. They work. These old TVs, they still work. The old radios, they still work. But, the efficiencies of the transformer, that's what's called into question, because you got all kinds of factors that play at the way that the transformers were actually designed to begin with. And through my experiments, while trying to study how energy actually transfers, I noticed that there's some things that could be, you can, like, for example, in the alternators, the standard alternators that they got, that you have to energize the, basically the rotor is where the primary coil would be. And the way that they're designed, with these big old metal pole pieces on each end of them, they shift the field from north to south because of the configuration of the way they're done. But that coil inside there is a really powerful coil. Once you put power to that thing, it turns that rotor quite literally into an electromagnet, a really strong magnetic field. And so that particular design right there, it's really impressive. And if you took that design right there and see how far you could expand that, see, alternators require that rotation in order to be able to shift that magnetic field back and forth from north to south. However, transformers like the microwave oven transformer, it doesn't work like that. You don't have to have the rotation. It's the field expanding and collapsing going across the windings the way that it's actually transferring that energy. But what I noticed, I had cut some tops off of those to make E-cores out of those transformers. And I noticed that once that top was off of there, that the transformer itself didn't push as much current out anymore. It wasn't as strong. But when you put it right back on top of there, not only can you hear that electromagnetic expanding, collapsing as that, because it's no longer welded to the E-core anymore, it's kind of just setting on there, but when the field is expanded and it turns into a magnet, that thing sucks down there real hard and you can hardly pull that thing off of there. That's how strong that field is. And then you can actually hear when it released, because you'll actually get a vibration because it's no longer welded to it. But the key is that magnetic flux is able to surround that entire coil because of that metal core in there. Now, in all actuality, if you had a metal core that completely surrounded the copper wire, then that would make it yet even stronger. It's about guiding that flux in order for it to not be leaking out into the air or getting too hot and producing the eddy currents that causes the transformers to get warm and stuff like that. But we know enough about them transformers to where we could quite literally re-engineer or redesign them to be a whole lot more efficient. And I also noticed that the more metal that you actually have around those coils, to where the metal is the basically like the pool, you know, or the bucket you're holding your water in. If you try to expand it past the volume of that bucket, then it spills over. So that would be your flux leakage that you would be getting from your transformer. But if you knew exactly how far that field was actually traveling, and you made your transformers according to how far that field's going to expand at any given voltage, then you would get the maximum usage out of that flux as it expanded and collapsed. Does that make sense to you, Muddy?
Oh, yeah. Makes good sense.
So, actually, the more metal you got around this doggone thing, the better, as long as all this metal's, pretty much connected to each other. The field's only going to go so far. And, the side effects like the magnetism, that's obviously going to be a different force. But the actual magnetic flux of that expanding field and collapsing field, it only has so far it can go out. You know, let's just say hypothetically a 12 volt magnetic field would expand out maybe 12 to 24 inches in diameter. That's how big that toroidal effect of the entirety of that magnetic field. That's how far the strength is. You see what I mean?
Right.
Like those wireless AC testers. That's how they actually test. Is when you get that within that field line of all that leakage, it will cause this circuit to come on. And so that's how much field you got around that. You don't need that much field around that in order to get that same amount of transfer going down those power lines. You could tone it back just enough to send what you need down the power line. So even the power lines themselves and the way that we transfer energy from the power station to the place, they got to pump a lot of power down those lines in order to get enough power on the other side for you to do it. So in the process of that, they produce a magnetic field around those power lines that is essentially wasted energy. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So it's not necessarily we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to have an understanding of what's going on when the wheel's turning so we can make it better. Transformers, capacitors, and everything. I think capacitors, for the most part, are pretty doggone impressive in their design as far as, you know, not leaking out and stuff like that. It's basically like a balloon. Once you put the pressure in there, it's there.
Yeah, and sure, more current, more voltage, and all that kind of stuff. But the thing about the wheel here, let me iterate on this. On a train, because it's on a steel track, and the wheels are steel, they get phenomenal mileage and efficiency, more than anything, because they're hauling a lot of cars and a lot of weight. The thing about a lot of wheels, your efficiency has to do with how hard they are and do they flex. And when they flex, because the middle of the wheel stays in, you know, in contact, and then more of it comes in contact on a regular tire. As it goes flat, it changes form. And it's just like if you lay down on the floor and you lift your legs and then you let them down, you notice that as you let your legs down, your shoulders drag towards your butt and stretches your back a little bit. The same thing happens on a wheel. And all that friction right there is energy loss.
Yeah.
But it's the traction. If you want more traction, you're going into the mud, let some air out of your tires. You want more traction in the snow, let some air out of your tires. But if you want mileage, you put more air in your tires. But you can't do too much of that, you wind up with bubbles.
Yeah.
So increasing the quality and the wear of your tires and everything, they've done things like put harder rubber. But the harder the rubber, the less traction you've got in, say, like the rain and stuff. So, I mean, like Dunlop tires on a motorcycle. Oh, my goodness. I switched from Dunlop to Continental on my motorcycle because when it rains, the doggone Dunlops, man, you've got no traction. All of a sudden, car stops in front of you. You better have 5 seconds worth of distance instead of that 3 second leap.
Yeah.
You got to have five. And I have almost had to lay the bike down and almost hit somebody's bumper. And very glad that I was driving cautious on that. So I've learned a lot on that. Wider tires, does that work better? You know, the wider the tire, the less pounds per square inch of your traction. It doesn't really mean that you're doing much. It just means that, the shop teacher in high school. We had a student that was always late and sometimes didn't show up because he liked to take off and go smoke a hooter or something with his buddies. And then he'd come in and, you know, and he was real good. He was smart and all that. But he was bragging about his four-wheel drive, hopped-up, jacked-up pickup truck and going out and mudding. And the shop teacher made him a bet. He said, look, he said, I'll tell you what. Right about the time he started making fun of the shop teacher's tractor-like tires on his International Harvester. They were tall and they were skinny. And he said, I tell you what, we'll chain both of our trucks together and we'll see who drags who around the school. And if I win, you have to show up every day. And he said, you have to make your grade. But if you win, I'll give you an A and you can show up half the time just like you always have. And that was a bet. They went on. So we all left class. And we went outside in the snow. And the shop teacher just kind of had his foot on the clutch a little bit. And basically he started getting drugged backwards just a little bit. And he let out the clutch. And he drug him around the school 3 times just to give him the shame. And put it down there. Them tall, skinny tires, they dig down deeper and got the grip. So, and like you say, reinventing the tire, it depends on what purpose you got.
Well, Matt, now back on that train wheel that you were talking about on metal tracks, you know, you would think that metal on metal wouldn't be a good idea, but they know the physics of it. They know the thermal breakdown of the steel that they've got. And so, actually, those wheels on the train, if you think about how much weight that they're actually carrying, you know, and the friction that one would think that you would actually get from it, you'd think those wheels would tear themselves up really fast, but they don't. I mean, they got tons and tons of more steel on top of that. And these train tracks and these wheels actually cool themselves with the atmosphere that surrounds them. So it's really quite a brilliant design. But there's trade-offs, like you get noisier wheels, obviously, but if you tried to do the same thing with rubber and put that much weight on rubber, you're obviously going to get a failure. You see what I mean?
Yeah, you're going to get a wear and tear. You're going to develop cracks and all that stuff. The deal is about the trains, the wheels on a train, is they're so hard, they do flex, but they don't flex much. And they don't need much traction because you got so many drive wheels on the engine, and it weighs a lot, and you're not trying to have jackrabbit starts, and the best thing is they got this little edge like a pulley on the inside, so you don't need to worry about traction for going off the road or something, because you're not going to. They're guided just like a pulley is or a rope is on a pulley. It's not going to go to the left or to the right. So, you know, they get the advantage of that. I think it was Dr. Raymond Hill that sat there and talked about, I think he said it was 44 tons. Yeah, it was 44 tons or 40 miles on a single gallon of diesel.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal.
Well, that's the whole thing right there. Efficiency, you know, and once you get that much mass going, you know, it almost helps keep itself going. So now we got all these understandings of how, you know, different things function, and that's why I keep saying if we can't improve on efficiency at this stage in the game, then people just aren't paying attention to what they've been taught, literally. Because basic science and physics, you know, it'll show you where's the best place to put your heater vents and your air conditioner vents. You know, heat rises, cold air falls. And so anybody with common sense would say you'd want to put the cold up at the top and the hot at the bottom so that you get the maximum amount of coverage in the air that you want to heat up or cool down. So when it comes to building transformers, now that we got an understanding of how that magnetic flux is actually traveling, regardless of we don't need even sit here and discuss the high-tech terminology or the mathematics of it, just the mechanics of what's actually occurring. When that field is expanding and collapsing, it's causing a result that we want, and we call it electricity. So we're getting, electron flow according to the electron theory or whatever, you know, but we don't need all the high-tech terminology to understand that field, once you put that power to that coil, that you're going to induce a current, and it's going to produce a magnetic field that's going to expand like a balloon. And it's going to stop at some point whenever the power of the whatever voltage you're putting into it, you know, finally reaches its maximum. That's how far that field's actually going to expand. So you've got all that distance that you can now redesign your transformers to get the maximum amount of usage out of that flux as it's going. That's why some people have figured out that if you wind the secondary right directly on top of the primary, then you get the maximum amount of power out of that. And so you could actually
wind them together.
Yeah. Wind them together and use the best materials for the cores that's going to reduce how much eddy current you get. And here's the thing about it. Here's the thing about the whole eddy currents and the actual transformer getting hot. If you could visualize That magnetic field and a flow of electricity or water or, you know, whatever, a large volume of water coming over the top of a waterfall, going down into a pool, as soon as that pressure and all that power hits that, it's looking for a place to go. And if you give it a smooth path, it can go right on through, and you don't build up the friction, and it's not backing up on you. So that larger core that I mentioned earlier gives that field a place for all that energy to actually go to. And so if it's not compacted in, if it's not leaking out the side, you're generating less of those currents that are actually producing the friction, which causes the heat that causes your transformer, if it gets too hot, to actually fail by trying to push too much current through, you know, a small pipe or, you know, whatever, you know, just understanding how that energy is wanting to travel, then you can understand how to actually design your improvements on, you know, what's, it's already a good product. It's a transformer. It works. It does the job, but it's doing it such an inefficient manner that we need to make it better. You see what I mean?
Right. Well, seeing as we're on the subject of transformers rather than wheels, the air core is the most efficient, unless you can find a focusing flux material that does not conduct any electricity whatsoever. But then you've got hysteresis and stuff like that. But the best thing for maximum power transfer is impedance matching. Impedance matching. That's the resistance at that frequency. So if you can make a coil down to almost zero resistance at a certain frequency, then all you have is the resistance left inside the wire.
Yeah,
that's called X of L. And when X of L to the secondary,
you have
maximum power transfer, even though you got your windings, the number of windings, your wire thinner, and maybe the number of windings is even more on the second, you can bring the voltage up.
You just use
and,
two
pop on the current, still have the same amount of power, and that's awesome. Especially to get rid of that core and go to air core. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you just use two terminologies that use high-tech terminology to explain what I did in a simple fashion, the impedance and the hysteresis of these deals. Basically, when that water was coming over top of that waterfall, if it had a smooth path to go, then you wouldn't even have had any of these little whirlpools that are actually produced at the bottom. It would just keep on riding right along. But it met resistance because, first off, the angle that it was actually coming down into that waterfall, it was a direct hit. Now, if you had a way to kind of gradually tilt that and run it off and widen it out to where exactly the amount of volume that was coming out for that waterfall was able to be transferred smoothly on down the road, that would be the smoothest waterfall that you've ever seen.
You mean like a bunch of buckets on a chain, on a like a pulley system?
Yeah.
Yeah, let it all fall gradually and evenly, and almost pretty much the same thing all at once.
Yeah, because you're still going to have the same amount of current flow regardless. I mean, the same amount of volume of water that came off of that is actually going to be transferred to wherever you need it to go, but it's how you allow it to transfer. So when we talk about impedance and, you know, resistance of this flow, they use that what would have been wrong as a right when it comes to nichrome wire and tungsten elements, because nichrome wire is actually, because of the way it's designed, is set up to resist current flow. So it's going to intentionally produce the heat that you normally wouldn't want in your circuitry. But the same thing with tungsten element. But these two both have different temperatures, operating temperatures, because of the types of materials. But nonetheless, the concept is still exactly the same. You're intentionally using a force that you know is going to be produced if you don't have the impedance then to allow this current to flow smoothly. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So by taking that, what would have normally been a bad thing in a good circuit, you said, now, well, I want that heat. So I need something that is going to impede the flow of electricity and actually produce those currents that are actually going to cause this thing to get hot. And that's what I've been trying.
Usually heat is dissipation in watts, and that's usually loss, unless you're trying to heat something, of course. And if you go out of your frequency range and start going too high, you get that hysteresis. You call it hysteresis, but it's hysteresis. And it's kind of like people. You let people get hysteric, and their efficiency drops drastically. Pretty much the same thing.
Well, try to explain friction. Try to explain that. Hysteresis. Try to explain that.
Let's put it this way. As electricity flows in one direction, it creates a magnetic field around the wire, and your wire is put into a circle so that all of one side of that wire is to the inside of that circle. And the flux goes in one direction. Then when you go to either stop the current or change it, that magnetic field collapses and puts the voltage back into the wire. And it has to change it. It's kind of like if you get out of the resonant frequency of that coil, which is basically, it wants to oscillate at that, kind of like when you blow into the top of a beer bottle or something. It goes whoo, whoo. You drink a little, take another swig out of it, it goes whoo, whoo. But you try to put a frequency into that bottle that's a little higher, like humming or whistling into it, it's not going to resonate. And it resists that frequency. That resistance, when the current is flowing, turns into heat. The deal is, the coil does not want to react at that frequency, or the core, your metal core, does not want to change the flux direction that quickly. It becomes more of a higher value of X of L, which is the reactance of inductance on the core. It turns into heat and dissipation and watts again and loss. So that's hysteresis.
Yeah, one of the things.
Same thing with people. They sit there and you piss them off, and they start trying to talk about all the things that are torquing their jaw all at once, and they make no sense whatsoever, and nobody wants to hear them.
Yeah.
So same thing.
When we're running,
which they get hot too.
When we're running our appliances at 60 hertz and overseas are actually running theirs at 50 hertz, one of the things that I found out in the process of working on my rotary switch was that the slower that wheel was actually switching that switch on and off, the more efficient that thing became, because it was allowing for the complete expansion all the way up. When the balloon's completely filled up, as far as it can go with the amount of voltage input you got going on, when it finally reaches its maximum, it has as much time as it took to get there as it does when it's collapsing back down to the opposite side. So if you allow for that full expansion and that full collapse, and then you get the maximum amount of time out of each pulse of that coil. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so if you know how far that field's actually expanding, now you know that instead of only having maybe two primaries, or a primary and a secondary, you got probably about 6-8 inches more that you could actually add more coils on top of. And as it's crossing back and forth, the only thing that those coils are looking for is a change in the polarity of the magnetic field. And so you get more for the input than you got out of the system that you had designed before, because of the system that you designed before had leakage of flux. There was unnecessary flux coming out there, and so you could have actually tuned that back to where your magnetic field was only expanding as far as necessary, just right across the doggone field, which means you could have turned the power input way down and still got the same amount of current flow out of the other side. And with it done like that, you're not getting all that excess heat that you would have got that would have been factored into now a loss in your system. Does that make sense to you?
That makes great sense. kind of reminds me of one day when I was working at the hotel, when I worked for the hotel, it had rained and the swimming pool was up to the brim. And basically the filter system has these little drains to the side where all the stuff that's floating on the water finally gets to and goes in there and gets filtered out. Now when the pool has too much water in it, that doesn't happen because it's above the drain.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna get it, I said, fine. I said, I can get that water out the pool a lot faster than sit there and going with the pump and all that and using all the electricity and taking it forever and having to waste my time at it. I just went and got on my swimming trunks. I went, pretty close to the middle of the pool where I was, I had my shoulders just above the water and could stand on the bottom and hold my position. I put my arms straight out to my side and I put my hands open like the fan. And I just started flapping them horizontally at about the frequency that I could feel their generated waves come back, and it would rock you back and forth a little bit. And all you had to do is just go with that rhythm.
Yeah.
And I swear, man, I was pumping out 20, 30 gallons per wave that come off each end. Whap, whap, whap. And I had that pulled down within probably about 2 minutes. I had it down to where it was just flowing into them little things there real quick. And then I got off and I went into the room there, changed clothes, toweled off, and I felt good. It was a hot day, and I figured that was the best way to do it. But the deal is, if I could do that at the one frequency, that from one end of the pool to the other, what I was doing was working on any harmonic that would rock the pool. But if I could do it at one, man, I probably could have knocked 100 gallons out the end of each end of the pool for a time. But it takes a while to get that going. But it was really easy. Didn't take much energy whatsoever.
Do you know of anybody who has ever done any experiments on running appliances that normally run at 50 hertz to 60 hertz who have done any experiments to change the frequency range before it actually goes into any given appliance? Like, let's say if I want to run an electric motor that will run between 50 to 60 hertz, do you know of anybody who's done any experiments to cut that back down to, let's say, maybe 40 or 45 hertz?
No, I haven't, but I do know it burns the motor out.
Well,
I don't know anybody personally has done so, but yes, it does heat the motor up.
Those
windings set to a certain frequency, what they want to run at, and usually the motors are right at 1,800 hertz. And but you look at the motor and it says 725. That's due to a slippage of the current and everything due to the metal inside the rotors and everything. It has losses. So if you want to use it as a generator, you go ahead and add 75 RPM to it. And you'll come out with the 60 hertz that you normally have on your motor.
Well, I'd like to see some research. I'd like to actually see some physical research. People running.
In other words, I'd have to say 1,875 RPM will generate 60 hertz, whereas when you put 60 hertz to the motor, it makes it run at 1,725, which is 1,800 minus 75.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I would like to actually see, so I can see this with my own eyes to get a better understanding. I'd like to see somebody doing research on testing the limits forward and back of input voltages to any given electric motor appliance to see whether or not. Because you know there's a certain amount of time that field is expanding and collapsing, and it only has to go out so far. Those two fields only have to go out so far to be able to interact with each other.
And the frequency range will be. Those were permanent magnet AC motors.
Yeah.
Now those things, you'd run them right at 1,800 RPM or whichever, just because of the way that they were wound and everything. The same RPMs that you get out of it. When you put electricity to it, the same RPM you run it to generate the same voltage, which actually be just a little bit, but you get a little bit lower due to the resistance, but it'll basically give you the same hertz at the same RPM.
Well, I'm on the input side right now, though. All I'm concerned about is the actual input. What that motor can withstand, higher or lower, what's the maximum? See, for some reason, the standard's 50 or 60. Now, can that be improved on even if it's only a fraction of a percent? Could it be improved on? Like, can I run my 60 hertz dills at 50 hertz and get better improvement on it? You see what I'm saying?
It depends on where that motor was designed. Like you said, some motors say 50 or 60 hertz, but if you look to see where it's designed, look at the frequency that it was...
A lot of them say that
the inventing or manufacturing company made it at, and you do better at their frequency.
But my question is that, like, there's got to be a device already on the market somewhere that you can take, like, overseas to boost your, if you're running something that's from here, you can boost it up to 60 hertz, or you can bring it from 60 down to 50 out of your wall socket. Like, it's coming out of my wall socket at 60 hertz, so could I lower it down to 50 hertz? You see what I mean? And even at that, could I lower it down yet even further and actually be able to test, does it get hotter at 40 hertz than it would be at 50 or 60 or even 70 or 80? You see what I mean?
I'd have to say at 40 hertz it's going to get hotter, and you might as well be running a square wave at that point, which is really bad on motors.
Kind of
a bad efficiency. Now, if you talk to Dr. Larry Woods, he'll tell you, even though you can sit there and you can run one is better, if you're running 60 hertz and it was made for 50 hertz, you can get better at 50 hertz. But he also says that 54 hertz, either one actually has a better efficiency. So if that answers the question,
well, that's rather than what 50 I'm trying 50, to get
54
to.
Hertz, 54 hertz, for some reason, just because of the natural magnetics flowing around it on the Earth, 54 hertz basically allows you to put more current and get more power out of it with less heat.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is I want to actually build me a testing deal where I can actually test at different ranges, measure the hertz range coming out and run it lower and run it higher and measure the temperature of both sides of that experiment right there, so that I know that, you know, okay, well, 60 seems to be the middle point, and that, so that's why they use what they use, so that I have a better way to explain, you know, that reason why that's made. And it could even go into farther as to, you know, expand this core. If this transformer core is, you know, only so many inches wide, and I know that I got this field expanding out past it, could I add material to that core to grab all of that flux instead of having any leakage whatsoever, and then run the experiment again to see the differences then? You see what I mean?
If you could add metal to your core, you wind up lowering the frequency. So that helps out there. But to shorten all that stuff, why take the temperature measurement? All you have to do is figure out the efficiency, which is the torque times your RPM, and measure your power and do the calculations. If you got a loss, then I'll tell you what, that exactly matches the heat and dissipation loss.
Well, yeah, because I still want to know how hot this thing gets. You know, I know that if that coil is shorted or you're putting too much current to it, it's going to get hot rapidly. Yeah, it's going to be fighting with itself in order to try to get the work done that you want. But I want...
Number one, if you could drop current, you will raise efficiency.
Yeah, well, that's the whole
usually
key.
You can do that by adding more voltage.
That's the whole key.
Keep the same frequency, more voltage, and you really don't have to really worry about the current. The torque that comes out of it, because you've raised the power input, the torque that you're going to get out of it. See, torque is your amperage. If you got voltage, the voltage wants to give it to a higher RPM. But if you raise the voltage just a little bit, it really doesn't draw more current. to achieve that RPM.
Well, that's...
That the frequency governs.
That's what I want. I want to be able to measure the minimum amount, the bare minimum. I mean, right on the line, the bare minimum in order to get this to run at its peak performance. So that you can right. actually tune this thing down. If it's coming out of the wall at 60 hertz anyway, but you for some reason figured out that if you brought that down to like 59 hertz, or even up to higher than that, over 61 hertz, just either higher or lower, brought that down, would that reduce the losses on either side of that fence, if you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So by figuring out where the bare minimums and the peak efficiencies of, you know, they could have just been satisfied right in the line 60 because it seems to be a happy medium. It doesn't get too hot and it's mostly efficient because of the way that they designed it. But I don't want to settle for that. I want to find maximum efficiency out of it. You know, it's not trying to draw too much current and it's not trying to, you know, get too hot or anything like that. That's what I'm talking about, you know, and it's not reinventing the wheel, it's making that wheel better, you know, by the way that we're putting this power to any given device. You know, there's a reason why they're using 50 hertz on one side of the fence and 60 on the other side of the fence. There's got to be a scientific reason why they do that. One lasts longer because it doesn't get as hot and reach its thermal breakdown. And the other one might fail sooner so you can sell more product for whatever reason that they're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we need to find out if we want to bring maximum efficiency into this. And every bit of this, if you're going to talk about designing the perfect generating systems and efficiency-wise and getting closer to what would be classified as free energy, as far as, you know, somebody got to have a working device to see, you know, oh yeah, this is really working, or, you know, it's actually producing more power than you're actually using. I believe that every single device we got right now is capable of running more for less if used properly. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, let me add this stuff to it. It's just a couple little things, and I got to put these together. And it has a lot to do with efficiency and making somebody understand what's going on, especially changing the frequency. Now, if you spin a motor that's AC, and you get an AC current out because you've increased the capacitance to run like a generator, and you look at the AC sine wave, you know it's not a perfect AC sine wave. Okay, but it's very, very close. And the thing is, now when you go to supply this motor with electricity, AC electricity, if you can get it the exact match of that almost perfect AC sine wave, then you've made it more efficient on that point. Now if we take like an inverter that's a square wave, and you've got to run that motor. The square wave goes outside the lines of that perfect sine wave. And everywhere it goes outside those lines, it creates heat and power loss. The power that's inputted into it gets put out as heat and is lost. So basically, you're going to get maybe 27% loss on your motor, which is 27% more heat. And that's why a square wave inverter doesn't get you, it's a loss in power and a loss in heat. And it heats the motor up and you're not going to get as much out of it. So basically the power out pretty much, even though it's like 20 something, gets very close to about 55 to 60% of your power out. What a waste.
Yeah.
And if you're taking it from your batteries, which you put in, let's say you put in 1,000 watt hours, you're only going to get like six on batteries, the lead acid batteries, you're only going to get like 67% of that back out of the batteries. So you've got a loss going in, a loss going out, which if you double that, is even more loss. So given your perfect sine wave, your true sine wave inverter, gives you full power, less heat, and you won't burn your motors out and such, and more efficiency out of your battery. Yeah. So all of this, it all comes down to impedance matching, anything that you can make sure that it all matches. The same as when I put my solar panels out there. The solar panel may be 55 watts. Well, I figure, what if I lose 5 watts on what they call a 12-volt solar panel, and I'm going to run a 50-watt light bulb. Guess what? In direct sunlight, I'm going to get full brightness on that bulb, even though the open voltage of the solar panel is right around 22 to 24 volts, which would normally blow the light, seeing as the power input or the power of the solar panel matches the power of the light bulb. Guess what? Everything else winds up matching 12 volts and the proper current due to the resistance inside the light bulb. Anything that you can match to the in and out, same thing when you're running. If you stiff leg when you land, it's going to pretty much stop you. But when you spring, your legs, you catch yourself and you spring just a bit and you boot back off, the same, you get a more efficient run and you're not wearing yourself out. That's why we run the way we do.
And
that works on everything, and especially even your tires.
I ran 7 transformers with 1 circuit by running them all in series with one another. I was able to run 7 transformers with 1 circuit. And I believe I could actually run a heck of a lot more with 1 circuit just by understanding how that magnetic flux is traveling through every single one of those transformers.
See, that's an excellent thought.
When
if these transformers are 120 volts, let's say they're 120 volts, and you ran 7 of them, well, 120 times 7, if that was your voltage and you're still running 60, guess what? You'd have a lot less heat going because all the same current going through each one.
Yeah, that's basically what I was saying. And plus, each one of those transformers would actually assist one another when the magnetic flux was actually collapsing in one. That back spike is going to go on into the next coil, and so on down around the sequence. You see what I mean?
Especially with the right capacitors.
Yeah. And so, when I talk about getting more efficiency, if you're able to run 7 transformers off of 1 power source and not cause that power source to have to work hard to do it, because those cores don't care where that magnetic field comes from, all right? They're just going to react to any magnetic change in polarity just like that. And so if that field is expanded way out there and you give it a larger path and basically you've calculated out to where the maximum amount of current and expansion of those fields is spread out amongst an equal amount, like it's like a bucket. If I got a 5-gallon bucket, I know that I can put exactly 5 gallon a bucket in there without any kind of spillover. But if I throw 5 1/4 in that bucket, then I'm going to get a quarter of that energy just got wasted over the side. And so by understanding how this energy is traveling and how far that magnetic flux is going to actually disperse, because it'll guide itself wherever it wants to go. It's going to take the path of least resistance. And so if I'm able to run 7 transformers as opposed to 1, that means that 1's not going to get hot because it's not developing those eddy currents inside the metal.
Right.
You see what I mean?
That is excellent imaginative. That is excellent imaginative. I mean, imaginative parallel.
Yeah.
And from one technology to another, you find out that these parallels are actually 100% true.
Yeah. And so,
it's like what I said before. I could make an amplifier out of water gate. I could have it act. I could take a balloon diaphragm to act as a capacitor. I can take a gate or a valve and have it act as a diode, which is a one-way valve for electricity.
Yep.
And if I have a long pipe, that acts like the inductance. The inductance, your length of wire or a coil, it says as you put voltage to it, the current starts out slow. Same as if you put pressure to that long pipe. All that current starts out slow and it starts building. Now if you shut it off real hard, it's either going to break out the end at the end of that pipe because all that momentum is kind of, it's pretty much what your electromagnetic field is doing. It starts building, starts going up, and if you could have a diaphragm at the end that takes that pressure, it'll sit there, expand. Now the capacitor is the opposite of induction. As you put pressure to it, it moves real fast at first, and then slows down as the capacitor gets full or the diaphragm gets full, and then it wants to swing it back the other direction.
Yep.
So if you can take a diaphragm and also a length of pipe, you can get a resonant frequency out of, just like you would out of an inductive capacitive tank.
Which
is a resonant tank.
I think
so that to do that, now if I could also take a little valve, and which would be like a diode. Well, diode's only part of a transistor. Now, if I take that little valve gate and I hook it up to another, with a linkage to another diode to allow more current, it opens another gate even more where the pressure is, I now have an amplifier of the wave and pressure that goes on that valve. It'll also sit there and govern how much current will flow through the secondary side of it. And that, with that, and if I sat there and I ran all that and did a video on YouTube, I could show somebody where I could amplify. I could amplify somebody's any kind of vibration that I put inside the first part. Now, if I wanted to sit there and put a bunch of vibrations and I wanted to tune to a certain frequency of sound, it'll only pick up that if I put a tank circuit in it, like I was saying, with a long piece of pipe and a diaphragm.
Yep.
It'd be like tuning to a certain radio station. The same thing. So yeah, I mean, and the main deal is the impedance matching or on the tank circuit, and how much what are you trying to do with pressure. Pressure is likened to voltage, and current is always current no matter what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that Gerard Morin understood what it is that I'm talking about here, because his experiment where he took a 2500 watt generator and he took the energy off of that generator and put it into a 50 kV transformer and then run that 50 kV transformer down into a 25 kV transformer. So basically what he did was he allowed that energy to be able to travel into that 50 kV transformer. And so that would start pressurizing that transformer. So obviously there's more volume in that 50 kV transformer for storage than there would be in the 25. So all he had to do was keep a steady flow of energy going into that 50 kV transformer. And as long as that 50 kV transformer never got low, then the 25 would always remain pressurized. And so he was able to run more off of that that generator than he would have been able to before, because he understood how that happened. If you've got all these appliances in there actually directly coupled right back to the generator, then that generator is going to get that back EMF, that's the lens effect, and it's going to cause that generator to bog down even harder, because the more you put on there and the more electron flow you get back to that generator head, the harder that engine has to work in order to get the energy out that you want. So basically he gave that energy a real wide place to go, and then funneled it down into a really smaller container, half the size, and was able to run more appliances steady off of that generator. He ran three 1500 watt space heaters, a reciprocating saw, and something else off of a 25 watt generator all at the same exact time.
Right.
And that shouldn't have been possible, because if you would have plugged them directly into that generator would have bogged down. You see what I mean?
Right.
And You know, that's another reason why them run capacitors, I feel like, are actually on, you know, electric motors, is to give it a little extra storage so that as that energy is coming in, it keeps a constant boost going towards that motor in order to keep it running steady. Otherwise, take the capacitor out of it, and it really doesn't want to self-start anymore because it's requiring, it's trying to use more energy than you can put in quick enough. You see what I mean?
Yep. That still goes along with, he's talking about running it up to 25 kilovolts and then taking everything off. And, you're going to wind up with more efficiency because the current, your fuses are rated in amps. The more current you use, the more heat you're going to get at every point of resistance.
Well, earlier, Stephen Givens posted a video in the chat room that I got a opportunity to take a quick peek at. I didn't get to watch the whole thing. And it says, the Earth gives us amperage while the sky gives us voltage. And if you think if you think about that, there's energy potential. And the way that this guy particularly designed this was that... he's got, like, in his diagram, he's got a diode going one way and then a diode going the other way so that this current can only flow in one direction from the sky, the voltage from the sky and the, you know...
Rectification.
Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about. That makes a big difference in how you're going to be able to pull radiant energy out of the atmosphere and the ground or whatever and get it to the point where it's actually... usable power by doing what Tesla was doing a long time ago. And he also explained in there about how a Tesla coil was actually sending power through the ground as opposed to, you know, when you see that big lightning display on the top, that's all wasted energy. And that's what I've been saying for years, you know. It looks cool.
An electron doesn't need to flow from my house to your house. See, the Earth is so big. It's not like on a capacitor. The size of the plate or the surface area on all them plates, that's why they make them so thin, because the electrons like to reside on the surface, pretty much. But the material inside, how many electrons are there, tells you, or its capacity to hold that many electrons. That's your capacity, that's your storage.
Yeah, but you're...
That's like having a big tank of water.
You're a
plant. And it's, say it's 20 foot tall, and you've already got the pressure on it because it's 20 foot tall, and you put a pinhole down the bottom, guess what? It's gonna push out maybe 20 feet.
Yeah, but see,
the size of the pole, and it's gonna do that for a long, long time.
Your appliance on the other side, it don't care. Yeah, it's just looking for a change in magnetic polarity in a field. It's looking for a wavelength. It'd be the equivalent of you sitting in the pool. You're got your wife's on a floaty on the other side of that pool, and all you got to do is start producing just a little bit of wave on this side over here, and she'll be going up and down, and you get that wave going at the right resonance, she'll be slopping over the side of the pool before it's all over with.
That's right.
Basically what we're talking about, you know? And if you understand that, then you understand there all these different frequency ranges that we're running stuff at. These, like I said, these coils, they don't care where that field comes from. All they're looking for is a change, any change. And some materials will actually resist that change. So by sending any given frequency into any particular substance like this nichrome wire, you know, it don't want current flow, and so, you know, if you get that frequency to be either slow enough or fast enough to either resonate this wire rapidly, it's going to get hot, or to cause enough current flow to meet the point where that resistance starts to produce the heat on there.
Right. Now, if you could, you're going to notice down at that hole where the hole that you put at the bottom of such a tank, that's your resistance. The higher the resistance, the more that little point right there is going to heat up.
Yeah.
And as the pressure goes from high pressure to low pressure, then the water actually gets cold.
Yeah.
But the main deal is the swap off is the heat. The heat due to the size of the orifice. You put a smaller orifice, now a bigger orifice there, it's less resistance, and you're not going to get as much heat. So, But did you also know that if you put a bigger hole at the bottom of that tank, that the water's actually going to piss out to the same distance due to the same pressure?
Yeah.
Just there's more current because there's less resistance. And that's the magic of thinking in parallel. A lot of 90% of everything that you, like I was sitting there saying, you think in coils and inductance, you're thinking of magnetism, the magnetic field. Well, we're thinking with gravity there.
Yep.
Or shall I say momentum and mass.
Well, earlier, Barbara posted a link in Skype for me. It's on extremetech.com. Researchers at Columbia University have conducted the first exhaustive study into kinetic energy harvesting. And essentially, they got this nifty little thing on here that as you're actually walking, it's using the kinetic energy of while you're walking to get some work done. It has a little ring with a little LED system built into it, and it actually lights up just by the motions of your, you know, hands while you're waving or talking or whatever, being all dramatic when you're talking. You're actually charging up the battery that is running this deal. And that's no different than what we're talking about. I mean, right. You're going to...
The parallel thinking of things. Kind of like my friend Donald W. Reynolds is one of my best friends. He lived down the lake in Sweetwater. His parents made him a set of skis that had two boards run across them because his legs kept spreading out. And he didn't have the muscles on the inner side to keep them skis from spreading out every time he tried to get up out of the water. And he was still learning to ski. Well, they put them two boards across there, and that was the trick. Boy, he came up first time, and he was so happy, and he was turning and going over the waves back and forth, left and right, and the boat took a left, and on the outside of that turn was a cement water tower. And basically, that kinetic energy storage in his momentum and mass, and he hit that cement tower, and we thought it killed him. But all that slapping the tower at once, actually he did damage the tower a little bit. And damaged him quite a bit. Damaged them skis real good. So it was a couple weeks before he went back out there and skied. It's a good thing they were going a lot slower. So once you get them up on top of the water and the waves and stuff like that, it's easy to keep them up there because there's less friction. And he was riding pretty good. So they slowed the boat down enough to keep them up there. But yeah, I guess that's enough on that. If you think in parallel, see that's me. When I sit there and I look at everything, I still look at it as potential and kinetic and momentum.
Well, everything.
I think you get the picture.
Everything that you've explained, right there, is basically how you can explain mechanically. Any electronic appliance that we're using. See, the subject of
exactly, and I love to make people think in parallel because it makes things common sense.
Yeah.
And with that common sense, when you see a problem, all of a sudden, it's an instant diagnosis in your head. What's going on and where the problem is.
Well, that's...
Where before, if you didn't know much about electricity, you'd say, oh, what part do I, what does this part do? How do I change this part? What am I doing? You have no idea until you can see it. But seeing it as water makes a difference on that. But,
well, once again, the phrase reinvent the wheel, according to the definition that pops right up there for, when you Google search it, whatever, it says they waste a great deal of time or effort in creating something that already exists. We're not reinventing the wheel, folks. We never have been reinventing the wheel. We've been trying to show you that there is a better way to use the wheel, you know, and there's more efficient materials to actually make the wheel out of, and with all that knowledge, to get down to an extreme amount of efficiency, let's say everybody stays on the power grid, all right? Well, that keeps the man happy, for one, because they still get some money out of the deal. But if you got down to the point where you now know how and what range, what to run the electricity that you're paying for already, so if the electricity is coming to you at 60 hertz and you found out that you can either ramp it up to 60 or more, or you can bring it down to whatever hertz range that that appliance is working friendly with, and it is not tearing it up, and it's actually staying cooler and working better, then that means you're not paying for near amount of energy that you would have prior. You see what I mean? It's basically as common sense as unplugging something from the wall when you're not using it.
Yeah, and I know I sat here and talking about efficiency and me turning it off into the electricity and the transformers and everything else there. I kind of drug us off the deal, but the point was, see, the more that wheel flexes, if you go down the highway, you're going to notice that when you feel your tires are warm or hot.
Yeah.
Especially if you're running across, say you're running across Arizona, which is one of your hottest spots, especially Death Valley and all that. You get out there in New Mexico and stuff like that where it's hot out there, and you're running down the road. I told my dad, he said he was going to Boulder Dam, and I said, well, Dad, bring me back Boulder Dam, because he asked me, do I want anything from there, because he was a truck driver, and, you know, comes in every month or so for about a week or so, and I said, yeah, Dad, bring me back Boulder Dam. And he came back, and he threw this big lump of rubber in my lap. I said, what's this? He said, I thought you wanted a damn boulder.
Huh.
I said, no, Boulder Dam, Dad, not a damn boulder. And basically, I said, what is this? He said, that's one of my inner tubes. I was running across Arizona, and the tires got hot, and pop the inner tube and rolling around inside there. It got hot, and that's what it wound up to. I kept that thing for like 15 years before I let it go because I thought it was so amazing. But your tires flexing because they have the weight on them, and just the flex of the tires is lost. Now, if you want to reinvent the wheel, this is what I was getting back to where I took astray earlier. If you want to reinvent the wheel, if you can stop the flex and still have the grip, now you've reinvented the tire or the wheel and made it very efficient.
Well,
because once you stop the flex and the friction due to the flexing, not just the friction between the tire and the road, but just the flexing itself, your tires shouldn't get hot.
I get you.
Basically, that shows up in your gas mileage.
I get you.
That's why the steel wheel and the rubber wheels make a difference.
I believe we have the knowledge and the technology to even reduce the friction and the flexing like you're explaining, and still be able to, you know, have a smooth ride. But at the same time, strengthen that doggone tire to the extent where it's going to have a lot longer lifespan than it otherwise would have. There's a happy medium everywhere, in every single material. There's a thermal breakdown point at which these things will start to tear themselves apart. And so even to the extent of actually cooling those tires down, if you modify the tire to where, like on a heat sink on a doggone, circuit board that disperses that heat, if you could take away some of that heat by the way that you guide the airflow across the deal, then you can get that thermal temperature, the temperature to stay at a, that happy medium that you're talking about. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Now you look at those, that wheel there, it's got the 6 shock absorbers around it. Man, what an efficiency loss. Now, I can understand the smoother ride, but that is an efficiency loss big time. Them shocks are going to get hot.
Well, I'm sure they're
probably on your car, you go down the road, your shocks flex a little bit. When you hit a bump, they flex good and go down. But on that tire, them things are going to be flexing continuously over and over and over due to the weight differential on one side to the next. I think the doggone shock absorbers would wear out a lot earlier than a regular tire would on the road.
Well, maybe so, but the point is, even that redesign of the initial wheel and the spoke system, you know, even if it comes with flaws, those flaws still have room for improvement. So you could not have to necessarily over-engineer something, but to be able to test and know where the limitations is of everything. See, there's no perfect wheel on the market right now. There's some really good wheels and tires on the market, but there's no perfect one on there because every one of them has an aspect of which, you know, like the different types of rubbers out there. There's some tires that, as you're driving down the road, you might as well just be running them across the sander, you know, and it's just throwing little particles of rubber in the air. But there's other tires out there, because of the way that they're made, they're more resistant to that friction, and so they kind of just, like, you know, flex like, you know, spongy gum or something like that. You see what I mean?
Right. You know, your tires, when they hit the flat spot on the road and that part of your tire becomes flat, the distance from where it touches the road is the front part of the tire, and the back side of the tire, it changes the distance or the circumference of the tire at that point to a smaller deal. And as it grabs the road, it flexes and it slips on the outer edge, or the as compared to where it does in the inner. On the front part of it, it's gonna try to push you forward, and on the back part of that flat part there, it tries to push backwards, and on the back side of it, it's trying to push forward. So you do have wear, even though it would just roll over normally if it didn't flex at all.
Well,
so all of that is what basically heats up your tire and such.
I think industry just settles for good enough. That's it. I don't think that they go for maximum amount of efficiency, with exception of those companies out there who want to sell a superior product and have it last longer. But even to that extent, they don't want to have them last too long, otherwise they ain't going to be able to sell no more of their product.
So, right, you look at a generator that they're going to sell you. You look at a doggone generator, and it's got steel cores and all that stuff. And normally, you're looking at 746 watts per horsepower. Now, if you're going to go for 1500 watt generator, why do they need a four or five horsepower motor to run it? Because the doggone generator is only 45% efficiency. Do they care? No, they say, oh, this is a 1500 watt generator, we're going to sell you this, rather than making the alternator more efficient, they just sell you a bigger motor, engine.
Yeah,
motor,
okay, engine. Well, listen to this. Then
they don't care because you're going to buy more gasoline.
With what you just said right there, with that knowledge in mind, thinking about if you knew the maximum amount of torque necessary to run, let's say, a 5,000 watt generator under a full load. I mean, the maximum amount of torque required to run that. You could actually design a system kind of like what Raymond was talking about, to where you don't have to put that much torque actually to it. I mean, they're saying this is a proven concept, because we do it from an engine to a transmission and gear ratio down through the drivetrain until you're going down the road. So your average engine probably wouldn't pull the weight of your car if it were not for the gear ratio of that transmission. So if you put a transmission in between the doggone gasoline generator to the actual generator head, if you knew how much torque it took to actually turn this under a full load, you could reduce how much that engine had to work in order to put that much torque out. You see what I mean?
Yes, but it better be a very efficient transmission.
Well, of course, but nonetheless, the same concept of Raymond's two-stage oscillator with leverage and torque and a large flywheel as opposed to a small flywheel, large pulley as opposed to a small pulley. Now that you understand, that large flywheel is actually assisting the amount of torque necessary to pull this load when it's under a full load, and all you got to do is maintain this steady amount of power, so you could have this thing on idle speed and it's pushing out enough power to turn that system that is actually producing the torque necessary to keep that running under a full load. You see what I mean? That's explained mechanically how that's actually happening. And so if you got a small 5-horse generator motor, a gasoline motor turning this generator head, imagine if you take that 5-horse off and you put a big old 50-horse motor on that thing. You don't need that 50-horse motor. You could run that 50-horse motor at idle speed, and it's got more than enough power to turn this under a full load because of the amount of power that this thing's able to produce. If you turn it up to full power, you'll explode that doggone generator head. You don't need to run it. You only have to run it at its bare minimum, and so therefore, that engine's never having to work hard in order to get the work done that you want. You see what I mean?
Right. Some could be explained in an alpha, beta, and gamma Stirling engine. Which one is the most efficient? If you look at the gamma or the beta, they both have linkage that change the direction, the force, and everything, and move. You have a rocking bearing, and you have a bearing at both ends of that walking beam, as you normally put it, plus the extra flywheel sitting out there. There's another bearing, and they turn much slower and have a much lower efficiency. Now, if you go to the alpha Stirling engine, which the flywheel is right there on the crank, and the crank is, you only got 3 bearings total instead of 7 or 8. You wind up with just the 3 bearings, the main crank bearing. That's the one. And then on those 2 lobes is the other bearing. And that is it. And the alpha Stirling engine is many times more efficient, and you get a lot of power out, a lot of torque, and a lot of RPM.
Yeah. Well, the key...
It's all due to how many bearings. That's why I say you go into a transmission.
Speaking of bearings, have you seen those little fidget spinners?
Oh, yeah.
Those things have incredible precision. I mean, you spin those little things, and because of the way that they're designed, they will spin for a long time after you stop spinning that. You take your hand and spin it one time, and they will sit there and spin and spin and spin for a long time because of the precision and the fact that they understand centrifugal force and so on. Basically, the flywheel effect.
The first ones came out with high efficiency bearings and no oil. They're dry. Due to the tolerances and everything, it's fine, and they're sealed to keep dust out and everything. And as they get older, you find out they don't spin as good, so they start getting loose and messing up. But the newer ones, they aren't as good, but they're loose and they're still clean and everything. But none of them. On any of them, do you ever find any oil? I found it is good to lubricate these joints and stuff like that. Now, on a Stirling engine, other than the Alpha Stirling engine, in order to get the thing to run and get any efficiency out of it all, do not put oil in the piston. If it's a flight, now a diaphragm's different, you'll never need oil. But on a piston, once you put the oil in there, now it saves the piston and makes it last long. But if you put oil in on a normal LTD Stirling engine, low temperature differential Stirling engine, or even on the gamma and the beta Stirling engine, the oil that you put in there, even though it has a viscosity, it still has a lamina flow, and the fluid has a resistance which would slow it down, and on some of them even stop them and make them not work. I don't know how many people couldn't understand why their stuff didn't work because the higher the weight of oil, the more friction. A very, very lightweight, like a clock oil or 3-in-1 oil, you might get them to run, but you're still going to have a problem. If you take that oil out and you just get a polished surface against a polished surface, or glass against carbon, or your neoprene and nylon. Now, you won't need the oil on them, and those are better. But I usually use brass against brass, and it was those sleeve tubes that are only like 1/64th of a second difference, and they're very thin, and I made my pistons out of those, and that thing just hauled. But I tried putting a drop of oil, and it just stopped it. But I had to tell a lot of people on that. It's, sometimes the oil is enough. Even though the Stirling engine is one of your most efficient engines, or motors, shall I put it, it has an external heat source instead of an internal. That's the definition of a motor. A motor has an external heat source. An engine has an internal heat source. It ignites inside there, and that's where you heat it. So that clarifies that. So it is a Stirling motor, not a Stirling engine.
Well, as I'm sitting here, I got one of these fidget spinner things in my hand, and I spin that thing up, and it'll sit there and run for a long time just by, you know, one little, you know, spin across that thing. But you can feel the forces inside there, or it's got like a gyroscopic effect at it. Whenever you turn this thing, it wants to ride itself and all that kind of stuff. All this physics that goes into this incredible little toy right here could be utilized in building perfect generating systems. Because
right.
If you understand how that magnetic flux is going and the changes that the wires, electrons or whatever is actually looking for, you know, there is a certain point when it's going too fast. And that's what I was trying to say, you know, on that rotary switch, was that it works its best because of the actual design it's got right now, but it could be engineered properly to have the perfect timing to pulse those coils. If you knew it took a 16th of a second every rotation to for that magnetic field to expand and collapse. That was it. That was the total time, expansion and collapse. You could design it at the perfect size and the perfect timing to every 16th second or 16th and fraction thereafter or whatever, every 16th second, then it pulses again. Bam. One there.
No, it's 16 cycles.
Yeah. So now you're getting the maximum amount of usage out of every single pulse off of that coil. And that's why I said the rotary switch was so important, because you're wasting more energy, because as you're trying to pulse those coils, you're not only getting a pressurization of the battery, but you're getting a pressurization of the coil at the same exact time. The moment you touch those on there, both sides of the fence pressurize because they're fighting amongst each other.
You can make it more efficient, two ways. You got a reed switch and the magnet, then you wouldn't have the friction of the brushes or your contacts passing each other. That's one.
Yeah.
Two, you need high efficiency bearings. You can get those out. Everybody has them laying all around them. They just don't know where they're at. Shouldn't end my sentence in a preposition. Sorry about that. Basically, they're inside VCRs on that head that spins. Your hard drive. CDs, your CD players and such, you get them in there. And what was the other one? It doesn't matter. But anyways, if you just start tearing those things apart and don't pry everything to bend stuff, you can get those high efficiency bearings, and that'll do quite a bit. But like I said, reed switches or Hall effect sensors and stuff, you get, even though you're running electricity and using a little bit, you get a lot more efficiency out of it than you would out of something that drags the contact across.
Yeah, well, even what in this rotary switch, I'm using rotary bearings. Those are the actual contacts, but because of lack of materials that I had available, on the other side, I actually got wires as the brushes. Well, that's not what you need. You need a contact point, which would, and actually you could time it out how long you want that contact to be made, as those roller bearings are rolling, they're touching two contacts, and you could actually put the contacts to be the length of time that you want it, and so it'd be a longer contact, so it'd be in contact with the roller for a longer period of time. But what's beneficial about the roller like that is they become quite literally a self-cleaning brush system, And so if you've got these rollers that are rolling around,
right,
and they're rolling on the contacts, they're not making and breaking that circuit shooting a lightning bolt. It's a smooth transition from the time it touches that till the time it leaves it. And any carbon that may get picked up as it's leaving that contact would be knocked right back off as it's rolling around the other
right.
side.
So just use a high efficiency bearing and make it dry so the oil doesn't make act as a resistance.
Yeah.
Usually oil. If you put oil on your battery terminals, you're going to wind up having a low voltage on your battery, but it keeps the corrosion off. But just go ahead once you put the doggone terminals on your battery, go ahead and paint the stupid thing.
But the plus,
keep the stuff out, and then things will last a long time.
The plus of having a rotary switch system like that, there's a lot of pluses, but the biggest plus is that you're going to get the maximum amount of efficiency out of your battery. Because
right.
as that battery, the battery is only using the amount of pressure necessary to energize the coil. And once that coil is energized...
You would have negligible loss from friction.
Yeah, once the coil is energized, it's got that much pressure in not just the battery, because the battery is waiting to rebound as well. The coil is also waiting to rebound, and the moment that contact is broke, you got a surge of power that you can then in turn guide off into a completely different system. And you still pulsed your primary, which in still in turn is going to pulse your secondary. So you're getting two powers for one. You're not actually violating any laws of physics by doing this, because that energy is actually being wasted. That's the back EMF. And proof of this is back when they had the doggone condensers.
Energy recovery, yeah.
They had condensers in the doggone distributor of your car, because when you had a point system, that make and break, when you pulse that coil, it would surge a big spike back, and that voltage was high enough that it literally started eating into the points. It was destructive power. And so they had to use a condenser to siphon that power off and put it down into the frame so that, you know, yield points would last longer. And so, you know, with that said, that means that other people was out there able to realize that they could actually capture that back spike and use that energy to help to rejuvenate, their power source that they're using. You see what I mean?
Right. Yeah, energy recovery is a big thing. I won the Texas slot car, what we call the state. And basically, I won the trophy on that one year. That's back, I think, when I was about 20 years old. And I didn't rewind my armature or anything. What I did is I took 0.01 microfarad capacitors from the positive to the body of the engine.
Yeah.
And one from the negative was already grounded. And I also ran one between the negative and the positive. And basically, just the recoil of that, the energy recovery in between transitions of the commutator and brushes, it would sit there and put what you would call the flashback, I guess, and store it in the capacitor and then put it right back into the doggone coil.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying. That's
yep.
exactly what I've been saying. See, you were doing it way back then.
By that and tweaking and all the little things there and getting everything down and using a very low ohm controller. I won that sucker. All by science and what I could figure out in my mind, and also zapping the fire out of my magnet.
Yeah.
Every time.
And also, spark gap systems. You mentioned earlier about reed switches. Reed switches make a good, spark gap as long as you're not putting a lot of voltage to it. But if you think about...
You put a voltage, just not too much current. The current is what makes them spark and arc, and then they get a resistance on them.
But if you think about how spark gaps actually function, if you're charging a capacitor up, a capacitor can only hold so much before it's going to want to discharge itself. So it's going to take the shortest path to ground. So if you got a long spark gap charging your capacitor, and you got a really short spark gap that is your discharge, it's like a lightning arrestor on a lot of these transformers. it has a shorter gap, and so it's going to take that path to ground before it takes its path across the terminals and explodes that transformer. That's why that thing, lightning arrestor, is actually in there. But you'll note that that gap is at a shorter distance than the distance between each one of these poles or these posts on the transformer. So
right, I can sit there and bring that into view. On the ham radio, basically the antenna itself was coming down through the signal wire inside the shield of the coax. The coax basically has a shield that wraps the whole thing and is insulated from that single wire going down the middle, just like on your cable, TV. Now that middle wire, if you take the shield and you kind of just split it at one point, lengthwise, and pull it off to one side inside a box, and you took a screw with a very sharp point, and you took it off the side of the box and brought it over to where it touched it and back it off about an eighth of a turn, you'd have no arc or spark with the signal that you're putting out onto your antenna and everything. But if the lightning hit it, that gap is so small that all of the excess electricity would jump over to that screw and save the finals and your radio set from boiling up.
Yep, my point exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
That's a spark gap arrestor.
That means technically...
Now they have lightning arrestors and everything, which just basically shut the whole circuit off, but they aren't actually fast enough to save your radio on some points, but the old technology, the old school, was spark gap arrestor.
But... technically, you would actually be deliberately overcharging your capacitor to cause them to discharge across that spark gap, but as long as they don't overpressurize, they'll never fail. And so,
right.
If you got two spark gaps, one for is your make and break circuit on your rotary switch and the distance that it'll actually be apart, and you cut that distance in half, it's going to take the short gap as opposed to that one, and so instead of actually arcing back to the commutator, it's actually sending it right into a capacitor with that back EMF that's coming off of the coil that you just energized. You see what I mean?
Right.
So you can guide this energy wherever you want it to go. In that process, every single transformer that we use today could be modified just slightly using that knowledge and sending that back EMF into recuperates, or what was that word you called earlier, the reclaiming the energy? What was that word? Doggone.
Yeah, you'd call it reclaiming if you want.
Yeah. Well, whatever that terminology was you used earlier, that's probably the best one. But nonetheless, it means that when you're running a primary on a transformer, it's going to expand, it's going to collapse, and that energy wants to go somewhere. So it's going to go right back into whatever power source that you're trying to run it off of and fight with that power source in order to, you know, allow you to use that transformer the way that you want to use it. However, if you guide that back spike into a different direction where it's not actually going into the back into the power source anymore, then you're going to get double efficiency out of this, because it only takes this much energy to energize the field that you want to energize through the core with the flux to your secondary. And you know that once you release that field, it's going to have a back spike that's going to start fighting with your doggone generator. So you allow it a shorter path to ground to wherever you want to send it, so that whenever it does back spike, it sends it off of this way, and you only use what was necessary to energize that field to its maximum. And so that means your generator doesn't have to work nowhere near as hard. It means you still got the work out of your secondary that you wanted. And even on your secondary side, when that field's expanding and collapsing, unless you're draining that energy off on demand, then you still got extra energy every time that doggone field collapses. You see what I mean?
Yeah, better yet, a tuned tank circuit to the frequency.
Yeah.
And you'll have all your energy in that perfect wave, that AC wave. And
yeah.
That helps for AC.
But doing it like
The capacitors on the DC motor, that's due to the arcs and stuff. It kind of takes them spikes out of it and throws it back in there and recuperates.
doing it like Gerard Morin talked about, where you're pumping it into a larger container than, you know, it's like a volume of water. When you take a water hose and you're filling up a 5 gallon bucket, you know, it takes you a long time to fill that 5 gallon bucket up. And if you had a lid on that 5 gallon bucket, you know, it might shorten the time, because if that was sealed, then you'd be actually changing the air pressure in there, which would, you know, be an extra force. But if there's no extra force that is slowing that energy from being able to fill that bucket up, then it's going to take you a long time. But underneath that, all that pressure for every bit of energy that you put inside there in a smaller container, that smaller container will stay full as long as you have energy coming into that larger container, and that larger container never gets empty. That's what I was trying to show with that one video. I think it was called 9 Volts or whatever. But
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
And so by utilizing that energy and putting it into a larger container than necessary, basically like the gas tank in your car, you can run your car off a quarter tank of gas because the system behind the gas tank doesn't need, you know, a full tank to run. It only needs a little bit of fuel, and it will run as long as that fuel tank stays. As long as there's any fuel in that tank at all, the rest of that system will function perfectly. All right, but the moment, you know, that tank goes dry, then it's the same concept. You run out of gas, and the process stops. Well, that's what Gerard Morin was showing, using that 50 kV transformer and putting it into a smaller system, which was the 25, that allowed all the systems on the opposite side of that 25 that only required so much energy. The 25 had more than enough energy to run all these other things, but you know, you weren't pumping the energy directly into that 25. Did you understand what I'm saying?
I lost you. I'm sorry.
Well, it's equivalent to filling up an Olympic-sized swimming pool. You
right,
got an Olympic-sized
right.
swimming pool, then you got a smaller one, and then a smaller one all the way down to a bucket, to a cup, to a, you know, maybe a shot glass, and then a thimble. All right? It's obvious the thimble is going to stay full as long as anything behind it is full. All right? And
right.
so for every... You can have a system set up to where you got this huge tank, and every smaller tank is running its own specific load, and that load will always stay running as long as you're putting any energy at all into that Olympic-sized swimming pool. It, as long as it never goes dry, then the one underneath it never goes dry. You see what I mean? But by
yep.
allowing that energy to flow freely into that Olympic-sized swimming pool, it's not having to work hard. It's just spitting the energy out. That's it. All right? That's all it's doing. And it's keeping that filled up. And so once all those systems underneath it are filled up, then they will maintain until you stop putting that energy. But the key is that the generator that is putting the energy into the deal doesn't have to work hard. It's not fighting against anything in order to keep that energy coming into the container, because it's not meeting any resistance. It's allowed to flow freely into the system, and so therefore everything underneath that is already pressurized because of the constant flow of energy.
Right. You got an energy recovery system, basically. You have a capacity or capacitance,
yeah.
such as a battery or a capacitor.
Well, generators
it boils down to buffering.
Yeah, well, generators are putting out more energy. They're capable of doing a lot more work than what we get out of them because of the way that they function. And we actually hinder those generators by running that power a completely different way. Now, imagine if you took what I said earlier about running 7 transformers off of one system just by running them in series. You allow that energy a wide area to go out into. You see what I mean? And so before you ever even plug in, you don't plug nothing in directly to it with the exception of the transformers. You run 7 of them in series with each other. They're just looking for that change in polarity. That's all they care about. They don't care about anything else. And if they meet resistance, then they'll send that resistance right back to the generator, causing it to have to work harder. But if you allow that energy to flow out into all these transformers, got a smooth path to go, you're not generating eddy currents, and you're not generating the back EMF that's coming back to that generator and fighting with that generator to give you the power. Does that make any more sense to you?
Oh, yeah. Maybe it makes everything more efficiency. Anything, you know, it's things. Here I go. I'm stuck on thinking in parallel, so I'm not going to bore you with it. But basically, anything without the resistance is more efficient.
Yeah.
And that's just all there is to it.
So if you built a massive capacitor bank, something that had a lot of storage potential, more storage potential than your generator was actually capable of producing, you know, rapidly. I mean, eventually, if you trickle charge anything, it will overcharge if you don't stop. You know, it's pressure. And so, if you have a massive capacitor bank and you're storing all this energy, it's got forces inside there going just like the water does. You know, for every gallon of water you put in that tank, you just added more pressure potential to once you open that drain. You see what I mean?
Yep.
And so if you're doing the same thing with electricity, you want to store this energy, you know, long enough till you get ready to use it, then you store it in a huge capacitor bank, and then you got a smaller one down there that you're using for your on-demand power, and then you plug directly into that one right there via your batteries or whatever. The higher pressure is always going to, you know, force its way down the pipe, if you understand what I'm saying. And so you basically have the equivalence of what I was talking about, the Olympic-sized swimming pool being your gas tank, and you're keeping that power where it's going in, you know, just at a constant rate. It's no different than what I was doing with that redneck hot tub. I was using a 110-volt element, which normally hot tubs were like 220, and you know, they take quite a lot of power and a lot of current in order to do what it is that they do. Whereas it took me 4 hours to get it up to operating temperature where it's hot, you know, where you can get in and swim in it or whatever. Once it got up there, all it had to do was maintain that temperature. That's it. It didn't have to force any more energy or drain any more current in order to be able to do that. It just maintained it. And if you left it on too long, it would continue to pressurize until it finally got so hot you couldn't sit in that thing, because it'd kill you if it's too hot. And it was getting more work done for less input. And that's what I'm saying, that these generators are actually capable of getting more work done for less input. Because of the way that we run it is the reason why the efficiency drops down and you end up using more fuel. Like you did with your car and the solar panel. When you put the solar panel on, and as long as your battery stayed charged, your alternator never had to kick on. And as long as your alternator ain't kicking on, then you're obviously saving fuel because your engine doesn't have to put more fuel to it to work harder. You see what I mean?
Yeah, it goes back to that deal where I was saying, you know, people want to put a bigger horsepower engine on the doggone generator just because they want to, you know, put an alternator or generator that's not efficient.
Yeah.
But it's okay, because people will buy it, and we don't care because it uses more gas. And that helps, you know, gas makes the world go round. Well, I got some gas for them. You know, kind of like when you know, talking about the government, you got all them sitting here talking about all them weather balloons expelling swamp gas up there. I got a very low view on what the government thinks and the way they run things and industry. So they don't care about you. They care about that almighty dollar.
Well, that's true, but it's.
I mean, you look at that alternator on your car. It's only 5% efficient. And I've explained this before, and I'll say it again because it's been a while, and I don't have somebody to interrupt me and try to just talk about something stupid just to get me off the subject. You know, a 5% efficient alternator only means that if you're trying to get a kilowatt of energy out of the thing, it's going to take you 20 kilowatts to charge the battery from what the starter had used before.
Yeah.
Only because it's 5% efficiency. And basically, that 5% alternator is taking one-third of your horsepower. Now, if it's taking one-third of your horsepower, it's also taking one-third of your gas mileage.
Yeah.
And if you put those two together, you wind up, you're only getting one third of the bang for your buck.
Yeah, but the system that I'm talking about would allow that alternator to very rarely ever have to kick on like really serious, I got to put power out mode, because even using, where those doggone alternators, the rotor inside there will actually retain a little bit of magnetism and actually become, to some extent, a self-exciting alternator. So even without putting power to it, your alternator is actually still producing energy even when it's idling. And even when it's not triggered to be on, it's still actually producing energy. So if you took that energy from that little bit of magnetic field residue that's actually left in the alternator, that is quite literally self-exciting that alternator at certain points, then that energy could actually be stored into a storage tank, just like what I'm talking about. And once that storage tank is full, any system underneath that will remain full as well. So you could trickle charge your battery while that doggone thing was in that mode. And then even when it finally did kick on, you're still running that energy through the same exact storage system where you're going to store the energy to allow it to, like, basically fill up a gas tank while the smaller system's still full. It will continuously keep that battery at a full charge, even when it's just idling.
You know what, buddy?
What?
I noticed that on my dual permanent magnet rotor axial flux, by gosh, wind turbine alternators.
Yeah?
Now, while it's sitting up there and the wind isn't blowing and nothing's going on, I'm actually getting a volt and a half to 2.5 volts.
Yeah?
Continuously. Due to the inductance out there on the line, and also just vibrations and the magnetic flux picking up on that and generating it off there and going through the rectifier.
Yeah.
And being, and it would build up till it actually does stick a little bit inside the motor if I put a capacitor up on it and then dump it. But as soon as the lower voltage in the battery, it didn't really help the battery much.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could have been, and I could have stored it, even though it's somewhat of a negligible gain.
Yeah, but see, it don't matter.
If you could collect up this negligible gain...
Even if it's a trickle going into a tank, it's still...
That's
energy.
Right, the tank actually fills. You got a leaky faucet, put a glass under it.
Yeah.
Why sit there and turn the water on every time you need a glass? Because that leaky faucet's gonna put out more than you can drink in a day. You might as well just keep a glass under it.
Look, somebody out there want to get rich in a hurry, I'll tell you exactly how to do it. Build a battery, basically a maintainer system for any given... All you have to do is connect it to your alternator and the other side to your battery. And all it does is basically stores power until it's needed. That's it. And it actually has the system to where you can't even overpressurize it. It will discharge itself safely into whatever else storage tank you need, or extra battery for that matter. But it's as simple as understanding how capacitor technology works, understanding how this energy is even traveling to begin with, especially if there's brushes on an alternator, which we know there are because that's how they get the power from the battery to the rotor in order to produce the field inside there that, you know, ignite or energizes that rotor. But even every time you magnetize and demagnetize something, there is a residual of magnetism left. And so that little tiny bit of residual, that alternator is going to turn anyway because of the belt system on there. Because of the way the engine's turning, it's going to turn anyway, so an alternator never, ever really stops putting out power. It just reduces how much power it's actually putting out because you're not actually energizing the field at that point. The regulator has already turned off the power from the battery because it's not needed yet. And so it's still producing power, even if your alternator isn't energized at that time, because of a little residual bit of magnetism that was left over from magnetizing and demagnetizing that thing over and over again.
Right. Not only that, that free sea of energy in different frequencies running across there in the mutual inductance. And then we also got pretty much the sea of energy in the vibrations of air around you, such as sound and even,
oh, yeah.
You know, even lower stuff, the vibrations of the ground, vibrating the prop and stuff.
Yeah.
Because you have a magnetism in there and coils, it is picked up just like a speaker.
That's
you
right.
You can use a speaker as a microphone. It's basic, but you can use a speaker as a microphone. It is a generator as well.
That
residual stuff. And then you're looking at old Stephen Gibbons here now. He said it's good to see you guys bouncing off each other again. Now, if we can retain that energy and put it through the microphones here, we're going to give Stephen Gibbons a little. We're going to stir up that energy in Stephen Gibbons, and he's going to have the energy to put out more good comments like that. So
I watched a video you did quite some time back about a cheap repair to an alternator. And
the Bosch alternator repair, yeah.
Yeah, and as I'm watching this video, and I'm actually, you know, you're explaining it really well inside there, I am interested in the fact that I can get an alternator replaced or repaired, you know, cheaper than I can go out and buy one. That was
yeah,
good knowledge.
Yeah, $180 as compared to $12.
But what helped me was, as I'm watching you do this mechanically, it gave understanding to the actual alternator and its functioning. And so with that said, that gave me even more ideas on things where you could actually make that alternator yet even more efficient by, you know, once that rotor is actually energized, you know there's some energy that's going to come back up out of that thing. Right,
right,
and straight across them brushes, it's going to look for a way to go. And if I can bleed that energy as it's coming back off of it into a different direction, so that it doesn't go right back into the source that I'm actually trying to pull the power off of to energize it, then that's extra energy that ain't wasted anymore. You see what I mean?
Yep.
And as many times as that thing will be pulsing per whatever per rotation, then that means that that's that many times that I can actually pull power on the flyback off of just the alternator alone. So there are ways that we can use the alternator even when it's not being energized because of that residual effect that's going on.
You know, I got this. I just bought this other car, and it's like put me in debt and all that stuff. But it was $1,000 I didn't have at the time. But I tell you what, it's got a lot of power. It's old 91 Honda Accord, and it's got that racing engine in it. Man, I love it. And it's also got that blaring exhaust that the punks put on them out there. But the thing is, I left the trunk open, which has a light on it. And I also come to find out, even after I closed the trunk, that the light stays on. So I basically just took the bulb out. It was a brand new battery, but the battery was stone cold dead. So I got a 45-degree doggone driveway that's washed out, and I figured, well, shoot, I'll just go ahead and back up and let the alternator charge the battery. I'll go ahead and pop the clutch. You know what? That didn't work. It's not a self-igniting, why they call it self-igniting. I'd call it a self-starting. In other words, the armature doesn't keep a residual magnetism on it, and so that if it spins, it starts generating. That's what it doesn't do. I was sitting there thinking of it, just taking the armature, and on one of those little teeth there that come down there as though between north and south, I was going to take one of those little magnets out of the hard drive, not the big one, but that little one. It's like about the diameter of a pencil lead. You know, that little extra one, you say, well, what can I do with that? And you go, nothing. Well, yeah, you could drill a little hole in one of those things and put that sucker in there. And that would keep it magnetically charged no matter what. So after you did that, it would be a self-igniter. I don't know why they don't already do that, but...
Well, they do to some extent already self-ignite because it doesn't completely lose its magnetism. But nonetheless, let's say you wanted to re-engineer just the pulley alone on an alternator so that in case you had an episode where your battery went dead and you know your alternator's good, Imagine if you had a centrifugal clutch on that that pulley system, so that when you bring your engine, once you start your engine up, centrifugal force actually spins the clutch and turns your alternator and does the work after that point. But let's say you were setting it was the engine's off, and you got the centrifugal clutch that's not doing anything, and you can take a cordless drill and plug it into this deal with a some sort of driver bit on the end of it, and you can spin that alternator. The battery already has a little bit of voltage left in it. Unless it's completely dead, it still has a little bit of voltage in it. And just by spinning that up, you can get that dang alternator to recharge that battery. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, this thing was deader than a Barry Manilow concert.
But even at that, if you had a small power pack, then you could put a little bit of juice to that battery. You know, just enough to trip the regulator on there that gives it a little bit of power. You know, and then start spinning it up with a drill. So if you had a centrifugal clutch, unless you could actually reach the RPMs that the engine did with that drill, then that centrifugal clutch would never kick on. You see what I mean? Nonetheless, the armature's still spinning around, and it's energized, so it's actually putting juice back into the battery, so you could sit there on the side of the road and spin your alternator around and charge your battery up without ever having to have your engine on. And without ever taking any belts loose or anything like that, you just plug it into like a center. They have like maybe a hex bolt in the center or something like that, and you got an adapter to go on your cordless drill. And all you got to do is
now I got you. Yeah. Now I got you. So you could actually spin the alternator.
Yeah.
So I take my cordless drill and stick it up to the bolt and go spin, 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 and let it charge up. And it wouldn't have to move the pulley at all. Gotcha.
Somebody said that back in the times when they used to have the old style generators, that when your battery was dead, instead of having to get a jump start, you could take the belt loose and just spin the generator around and get enough juice back in your battery in order to put the belt back on and start the doggone thing. Do you ever hear that?
Say that one more.
The old style generators, like they used to have, like the old Volkswagen generators, they were DC generators or whatever. They had permanent magnets in them or whatever. And so, if your battery died and you couldn't get your vehicle started, you could take the belt loose and spin that generator around and put juice back into that battery until you got the battery voltage up high enough to actually start your engine. Then you put your belt back on and start your engine up. So, without having to have jumper cables, they were using that generator to charge their battery up enough to get that battery where it could actually start the starter motor.
Yeah, you'd have to spin it at a pretty decent RPM.
Well, I'm sure
probably
that...
Probably do something geared up like an egg beater, the old crank egg beater. Yeah.
But just think about what I said about the alternator, though. If you had a centrifugal clutch that the RPMs that your engine would be idling at, it would kick that clutch on and turn that belt anyway. But without the engine running, you'd have to match those RPMs in order to be able to get that alternator to, the actual pulley itself on the alternator to run. However, you could still run the shaft to the armature with a drill on the front of it, and it would still spin that rotor around. You see what I mean? But they don't have to fight against the belts because the belts, the centrifugal clutch isn't on. What do you think?
Yep.
See, that's mechanically. That's thinking of things mechanically, man.
Yeah, somebody was trying. Yeah, I mean those old generators, they didn't have a fluctuating voltage due to the changing the charge in the field winding. They had magnets, permanent magnets and brushes. The thing is on those, the only way that they could actually regulate the voltage was through a little relay, and basically the relay would have a resistor in line with the coil, the magnetic coil, or what would the coil, And when it got up so high, it would sit there and bring the switch the armature, which is basically the switch, the part that pulls down to the coil, and it would turn it off. And then when the voltage dropped down, it would let it back up and start charging again. And you could adjust your voltage on them old things.
Well,
that was called a mechanical voltage regulator. And I actually tried to do that on the battery system down at the shop. And I was successful for a little bit, but then just the dust and vibration, and it was so sensitive, the adjustment I had on it, it was nothing but a regular relay instead of one of the old Fords or something like that. It would change, and it would like either overcharge the battery and then drop off, and then it wouldn't charge it unless your battery went real low. Getting that window of where it needed to stay off, getting it to stay stable was a hard thing. So I got to give them designers a lot of credit from way back when they did when they had made those voltage regulators. I think the best deal would be to get one off an old vehicle.
Yeah.
That had a generator on it. I could probably utilize that in my system. I get tired of electronics.
Anyway, I'm going to have to post.
How many charge controllers I've gone through that just burn out because they're nothing but semiconductors?
Yeah.
Semiconductors have a rough time sometimes.
Well, I'm going to have to post this picture that I put one in the Skype for you. It's alternative cuss words that Stephen Gibbons posted in the chat room. It's got different sections, like if you're miffed or exasperated or I'm not having it, and different, you can, you know, like shucks, rats, gosh, shizzle, toot, and so on down the line. Anyway, it's pretty funny. You just got to check it out, but need to pass it on to prospective guest on the Mad Science Show. That's a good idea, Steve. Huh?
When do you post this? Way up the line?
It's in the Skype chat right now. I posted it in there. Yeah, Stephen posted it in the Shaziz Radio chat. So we'll have to share that around. Keep a copy of that on hand. Anyway, so basically what we're talking about is not having to reinvent the wheel, you know? I mean, the wheel is, it's got its uses. It could be more efficient, and there's, you know, all kinds of potential there, you know? But making it better, making it more efficient, that's what we're talking about. And same thing with electricity. When we're talking about alternative energy, free energy, whatever, it isn't that we don't have enough power. It's that we're not using it properly. We're not using it in the best fashion. So even the transformers that we use, the wasted energy, if it's generating heat, then it's not running right. Plain and simple. Unless you intentionally want it to generate heat, in which case then you know what causes things to generate heat, like what I explained with the nichrome wire and the tungsten element. They resist current flow, so they're quite literally a resistor, and that's why even in your circuitry, you'll note that your resistors get hot, or the semiconductors, like Muddy just mentioned, that why they reach the thermal breakdown and they fail. So there's got to be a better method, and there probably already is a better method for using, you know, voltage regulators instead of using semiconductors, unless you're not going to be having to pull so much power from the opposite side, or push too much power from the power source itself, then that transistor or resistor is perfectly fine. Resistors are only there to cut down the current so that it don't destroy something that's on the other side that can't handle as much. And so with that said, if you design it right from the get-go, you don't even need a resistor in there, because you're only putting the amount of power necessary to get the job done on the other side. You know,
right.
That's the same thing.
A noisy prop is lost. If you got a stereo that's maybe 20 or 30 watts, and you're getting the same amount of noise out of your prop, you're losing 20 to 30 watts.
Yeah.
Because it's generating audio. Also, the heat. If you got a hot alternator, then it's a dissipation in watts and heat. And that's a power loss as well. That is efficiency loss. That's a common sense look at it.
Yep, and we can actually bring those down to the maximum efficiency just by running tests to find out at what RPM something begins to vibrate or resonate or whatever, and at what RPMs they run, you know, smoothly without actually producing that extra sound, which would be wasted energy, and so on down the line. Everything can be improved on. It's not reinventing. So as far as I'm concerned, this terminology about reinventing the wheel, you know, waste a great deal of time or effort creating something that already exists. It's not about that. You know, we're not trying to reinvent energy. We're trying to show a better way to use energy, which means more efficiency, which means a smaller carbon footprint, which everybody knows how I feel about the whole carbon emission hockahooey. But nonetheless, if they're going to complain about it, then they should be working for efficiency. And when people reach that efficiency or exceed that efficiency, then that information should not be suppressed. There are systems out there available that if you ran your car differently than you do now, instead of injecting a jet of a stream of liquid into your doggone fuel deal and then breaking it up a little bit and then, you know, running it through your combustion chamber, if you vaporize that before you put it in there and you put it under the right circumstances, the right temperature, and so on down the line, well, then now you raise that efficiency up so incredible that you could get hundreds of miles per gallon. And you don't have all the excess waste, because the faster that engine runs, common sense dictates, the faster that piston's going up and down, the faster those valves are opening and closing, the less time that you have for a complete burn and to be able to retrieve that power that you want out of it. So you're spitting more fuel out the exhaust than you're actually using. And so with that knowledge, now you re-engineer how you're actually utilizing the fuel, and you put it in there in such an efficient manner that you're only putting in the amount of fuel necessary to produce the effect that you want, which is the piston going down. And from that point on, the harder you mash down on that gas pedal, the less fuel you should be using, because you know that you don't have enough time to burn that fuel like that.
Correct.
And if you take,
and as you raise the RPM of an engine,
yep,
you have sort of a you have sort of what is described in a transistor as a slew rate.
Yeah.
You know how fast it can switch and stuff.
There
you go. Your timing has to be adjusted as you go up in RPM.
And
also with the torque.
And then you could actually have a dual fuel system in your car, just like the farmers did in the tractors, just like the people did in the airplanes. You could have a dual system in there. Once you got that up to operating temperature, you could kick over from this fuel to actually running water through the system. Water is a fuel. I don't care how many people out there want to try to tell you that water is not a fuel. Oh, you can't compress a liquid. We're not talking about putting it in a liquid, because that would be stupid. Where you take that fuel, you break it down to its smallest molecules into a vapor, and then you inject it into that system at the right time. Now you're not burning the so-called fossil fuel. Now you're burning this other type of fuel that actually can self-regulate its own temperature. That's how impressive that the water molecule is, because it's the most stable molecule on the planet. And if you utilize properly, then you get, you know, water out the exhaust.
Yeah, that's what you call the difference between a turbocharger and a supercharger.
Yep.
A supercharger also, on top of using the turbo or the speed of the exhaust going out to turn a turbine to sit there and ram more air into it, you're also ramming a little bit of vapor into it, which gives it more compression. And your fuel has a certain amount of water in it. Germany, when they were going through the war, they realized that they were so short on fuel and they had to be really efficient. They actually added water to their diesel fuel.
When you
gave it a stir and a mix up to the maximum that it would hold without beating up and separating,
yep,
which gave the diesel much more efficiency.
Also, when you're ramming that air into there, you're ramming hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and whatever else might be in the air. You're ramming that in there as well. So you're actually ramming fuel in while you're ramming the air in, because the reason why you've got to bring more air in is to match the amount of oxygen necessary to complete the burn inside there.
But, and if they actually ran a coil around the fuel as it was entering in, they'd wind up with more hydrogen and oxygen to burn.
Yep, and you could actually take in from, you could start off running it off of, you know, the highest octane fuel, and then start running it on water, and then quite literally start running it on the atmosphere that's surrounding it, because what's in the atmosphere is the same thing that's in that water. It's already broke down to its smallest extent. You see what I mean?
And if you do that, you also have to change the timing once again. Well, has that much of an effect?
Just like an automatic transmission. It changes its own timing using gear ratios. When you get it up to a certain RPM, this one kicks over here, and then when another one, this one kicks over, and now you're in your highway gears. And when you go back, when you start slowing down, it starts working in reverse, going down, bringing it down to your lower gears. So,
a torque converter is actually more efficient.
Yeah. For every monkey wrench they throw into the possibilities, we got a solution for every single one that they don't want to throw out. The whole thing is, if you use the energy the same way that we're talking about, then you're going to be more efficient. You'll pay less on your electrical bill because you only need... You know, there was actually a guy, and this is a true story. You might be able to find it out there on the internet, but he built a generating system that ran off 120 volts AC, plugged it into his wall, and he ran the rest of his house off of that deal. Now, the power company got mad because they said that he was stealing electricity. There's no way you're running this entire house off of that amount of energy. Well, he was. And so when it finally ended up in court, they couldn't have him charged with stealing electricity because he was paying for everything that he got. He was just using it in such an incredible, efficient manner that he didn't have to pay very much.
Well, I believe you're talking about Dr. Robert Searle, aren't you?
I don't know what the dude's name was. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was Dr. Robert Searle. And the deal is they still kept him in jail. And the reason why they did that, because they knew that it worked.
Yeah.
And the fact that it worked, they had to sit there. They told his landlord, which was an old lady, you know, that, you know, I forget what they told her, but basically they confiscated his notes, his equipment, and all that stuff, and they kept him in there long enough to have him evicted, and so everything was lost, and then they let him out.
Yeah.
They also told him, don't do it again or we'll put you back in jail.
Well, so, he wasn't stealing nothing. He was using it super efficient. And so the reason why I wanted to bring that particular episode up was that if you took that information that he was using to take 120 volts and use it so efficiently that he was able to generate enough power to run the rest of his doggone house, then you can build a device that you can plug into any standard generator, and you can get that generator to run so incredibly efficient that you can run a whole heck of a lot more off of that generator than you can imagine. A 40-watt solar panel would run a lot more than you think it would if you use that energy properly.
Now, if you build an over unity generator, and the one key thing that you're going to notice is that it doesn't run hot. It runs cold. It might even build up ice.
Yeah, but see,
it's absorbing the energy around it and putting it in there, and that's what you're taking out of it.
The term,
that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, the term over unity, though, that's one of the problems that we got going on, because in reality, you're not creating more energy than you put in. I mean, it's already capable of producing a massive amount of power just by the actions that you've done, and it would be actually, if you did the math, would be classified as over unity if you wanted to be honest about it. because it don't take as much. But you're actually getting out the same amount of energy that you put in. It's just being dispersed and changed into a force that is stronger than what it was required for you to put in. So
right. Well, in effect, basically, what you've done is you've built an energy harvesting machine.
Yeah.
Dr. Raymond, Boomer, Dr. Raymond Head was sitting there always talking about his idea of free energy was a steam shovel. It'd pull out more coal than it took to operate the machine.
Yeah.
And basically, yeah, what it took to run the machine, he'd pull out more energy or more energy source. It's pretty much the same thing when you're looking at an over-unity deal. If you're getting more power out than you're putting in, you're going to find out it doesn't run hot, except for something like the air hammer. Now it's putting out heat. That's what it's designed for. And the energy put out in heat is a whole lot more than it pulled in, on the source.
Well, if you actually did the mathematics, I'd love somebody to just humor me for a minute. Do the mathematics on an average internal combustion engine. Measure up the, because we already know it's inefficient because it wastes more fuel than it actually uses, but measure up the amount of energy that is produced by the average internal combustion engine in temperature wise. You know, if you think about how hot that engine gets without the radiator, it will literally destroy itself. And you think about the temperature
that heat that you heat the car with is free.
Yeah, it's
and you
actually
might produce it because the combustion inside the chamber called the piston.
Yeah.
Only 5% of that actually reaches your rear wheel.
Yeah, the temperature, average temperature of all the automobiles out there are running anywhere from 180 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit at any given time. And so all that energy has to go somewhere, and so we use radiators to try to bring, you know, the temperature down and maintain it at a certain, you know, operating temperature, otherwise it'll destroy itself. Well,
yeah, and instead of venting all that doggone heat off in a radiator and recirculating everything, find another way with energy recovery.
Well,
now, you've got a hybrid engine out here, and basically you have to call it an engine because it's internal combustion that powers the alternator as well. And it's also, that alternator also doubles as the motor. Now, you store that energy off your nickel cadmium batteries. I'm sorry, nickel metal hydride batteries. Now I had it before, and you know those nickel metal hydride batteries. They're only good for like 8 years, and I had a 2003 Honda Hybrid, still do. But as I used it, I mean, it was great. I was getting 47 miles to the gallon, and I thought that was awesome. As the batteries finished wearing out because it was a 2003, you figured, man, those things are overdue for going out. I've got very little power assist back from them, and I went down to 37 miles per gallon until piston number 3 got a hole eaten in it due to improper mission. It had a vacuum leak towards that piston, and it caused the mixture to go hot, and it burnt the hole in piston number 3. Man, I had very little power, and once in a while, that battery would charge up, and that pedal assist would make a whole lot of difference, and I wound up going down to 25 miles to the gallon.
Well, imagine this.
So, yeah, all that makes a difference, so I got to see what the hybrid system of energy recovery and sticking it back into the torque to the wheels and stuff. I got to see what that difference was. It was close to about a quarter of my mileage.
Well, imagine this, Muddy. Water will boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, is what everybody says. All right?
Right.
If your engine's running at 220 degrees anyway, or 180 to 220 degrees, it don't take much to kick it over past the boiling point. It depends on the volume of water that you're trying to turn into steam and so on. I mean, if you go out there right now and throw a drop of water onto a 180 degree temperature, engine, that water will begin to boil. All right?
Yeah.
So, nonetheless, if you engineered system to quite literally produce steam from the wasted heat of the engine itself, and then you had a transmission that was actually a hybrid deal that ran off of not only from the torque converter and hydraulics through that portion of it, you know, spinning the clutches inside the transmission, but you also had a steam assist system that would be tapped into the same gear, so that when that engine got hot and produced steam, that steam would then in turn expand and pressurize into a container and run turbines that turn in gears that helps put energy back into that transmission, making that transmission not have to work near as hard, which in turn makes the engine not have to work near as hard. You see what I'm saying?
Right. So you'd have to have a decent sized container that would sit there and hold the water as it would flow through, and you'd have to insulate the outside of the engine and not let any of that energy escape and heat or as much as you possibly
do. Well, sure. Well, there's a wheel, there's a way, though.
Go ahead and put that to the free-running wheels, and you wouldn't have to interfere with the rest of it, and you have it shut off when you take your foot off the gas. Yeah, that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Heck, you can turn the engine off for a little bit and let that steam going.
And the electric motor on your fan, if you was actually running this same system through your radiator as well, using the radiator as a water source or whatever, then your electric fan wouldn't have to kick on because it never reached that, higher than 180 or higher than 160 degrees, whatever temperature your fan normally kicks on. It wouldn't be kicking on because you'd be dispersing that heat.
Yeah, 190. But and it's under pressure that keeps it from boiling. Well, if you take that radiator cap off, man, it needs to do some damage.
Oh, yeah.
But now, if you could take that steam and everything out there and just let it, you know, go ahead and let it build up and stay on that. Now, if you could sit there and be able to turn the engine off and run on that for a little bit, you look at the system, all the electronics, the AC, it's running an AC axial flux motor, which is also a generator. It doubles as a generator, and it's 97% efficient.
Yeah.
The axial fluxes. Now, the thing is, in order to run an AC three-phase motor and have the batteries for storage, that system costs close to $3,000, but they're charging you a lot more for the whole thing. Your battery, the battery and the regulation and the battery equalizing system, meaning that none of the, since you have a lot of the batteries that are in series, you don't want one battery to charge up more than the others. You're going to pop the good battery, and the old battery, the bad batteries are actually make it through, and you just ruin your system. If a boiler tank and some steam actuators on the rear wheel were put in there, it would cost a whole lot less. I mean, a whole lot less.
Well, we've explained...
It's low tech, but it would actually kick butt in comparison.
Just in this show alone, we've explained a whole lot of different functions on which were how you could improve efficiency and use what would have normally been wasted energy to assist that engine or that transmission or the drivetrain to be able to do the job. See, the Koenigsegg, that thing has a gasoline engine, but it has an electric transmission, which makes this thing incredibly fast, because the way that they put this energy from the engine, it's actually running a generator that's running these electric transmissions that's making that car move, top speed in almost no time whatsoever. But even that system right there could be improved, because you could take the heat off of the engine, which at most times only has to run at idle speed in order to turn enough power to run that thing. But even at maximum potential, when it's generating all that heat from the combustion portion of it and the vibration as well, that heat could be transferred into so many different mediums, like what's going on with the Peltier element. All you need is a temperature difference, and now you've got extra energy that's able to, you know, be cycled into wherever you need it. So, even that one could be even more incredibly. As far as I'm concerned, the most efficient engine on this planet, the most efficient automobile on this planet is the Koenigsegg, and that thing is incredibly fast.
Now, what do you call it?
The Koenigsegg?
Never heard of it before.
You never heard of it? I'll have to... While you talk, I will Google it up, and I'll send you a picture of it and a link to it. And you got to get on YouTube and watch these cars. You will be extremely impressed.
Now, you also know the Subarus, which are really, I mean, they're bad A, man. They are awesome. The Subaru actually had 52 miles to the gallon and lots of power. And a lot of them are even four-wheel drive. Now, you get up around Canada and up around Washington State and the upper states up there. Well, I tell you what, there's a lot of them up there, and they're in demand. And I tell you what, man, it doesn't matter if it's an old one. These guys, it has a lot of work that needs to be done. These people will buy them up and take them. Now, I got 47 miles out of this hybrid. 47 miles to the gallon. That's still less than the 52. Now, if we made a Subaru hybrid, the government would probably shut them down and tell them that you can't sell them because there's just not a... They're not using enough fuel.
All right, I posted...
Matter of fact, Gabby, you go down to... You go down and you put your hybrid in or your electric car, they have a special tax rate for them things. Just to make up for the money and sales that they didn't get off the oil.
I posted
that
a link.
Hot.
I posted a link in Skype, and I'm also posting it right now into the chat for those who want to check out this car as well. But you want to talk about engineering. This guy has engineered the body of this car. He's engineered the engine and everything that works on it. It has two exhaust systems, one to cool down the batteries, and the other one for the engine itself. And this car is not only incredibly beautiful. I mean, I love this car. I'm in love with this car. This car is incredible. It's by far the most efficient and best looking car on the planet today. And when you take a look at this, go to Koenigsegg.com and look at what this man accomplished with this car. It'll blow you away. I mean, it is that impressive. But this is what I'm talking about. This is taking engineering to its fullest extent. I mean, you just take and you know what causes what to happen. You just take this car and you take every bit of knowledge that we've been talking about here. And let me see if I can open the image in a different deal.
Fastest car in the world.
Yeah. That is one beautiful looking car, man. I'm going to post a copy of a picture in the chat room if I can get that to go down there as well. But, man, and they come in multiple different colors. You can actually have this car custom to your deal. Now, keep in mind, because of the limit of, they're going to be expensive. All right, but you're talking about a work of art. You're talking about a car that has been engineered for all kinds of different advantages over another car as far as aerodynamics and the way that this car does what it does. And, I mean, you can't say more. That if you get more people on the planet that take it to the limit like this guy did with the Koenigsegg, that's what we're talking about. And
it kind of looks like old George Sprague, the guy that does all them slingshot deals.
Yeah, but when this radio show's over and you got some free time, go watch some videos. As a matter of fact, on this website, he actually has a video posted on this website where you can see this car driving and stuff. And look them up on YouTube and check out these cars. If I was ever going to recommend a hot rod for the rich kid, this would be the one right here. Because these cars, when they go to car shows, they command the car show. Everybody's over there watching this car. They don't care about the rest of them. They're watching this car. This is the legend of cars right here.
0 to 400 kilometers per hour. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
$9.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, buddy. And I'll tell you what, if people pay attention to what we're talking about here today and they actually step outside the box and, shoot for maximum efficiency, first off, you're going to find free energy if you're looking for it.
How much do these cars run?
I think the first prototype was $7 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but I think they're getting a little bit cheaper.
Oh, they have to over time.
Yeah.
They get quite a business.
But you got to think about how much engineering and how much handmade stuff went into this car, the carbon fiber and the design of, man, I tell you, they went all out on this vehicle. But back to what I was saying here, if people out there step outside the box and they shoot for maximum efficiency, they will find free energy. No ifs, ands, or buts. For example, that guy that we was talking about, I think you said was Searle. And he was running his entire house off the equivalent of the power coming out of one wall socket. Well, imagine that system right there connected to any 2,500-watt generator. And you can run your whole house off of that now because of the way that you're using that energy. It's not that 2,500 watts isn't more than enough power to run your house. It's just that you're going to run into all these resistance and if inefficiencies throughout your house. So it's going to cost you more energy to try to do that. That generator can't handle it running it direct. However, if you run that generator like Gerard was into a transformer, that allows that energy to flow out freely instead of meeting resistance, and then you take that stored energy and put it into a smaller one that compacts that energy to now give you back your current watts and amps necessary to run that inefficient crud. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
That's the whole secret. It ain't that your car couldn't run all hundreds, if not even thousands of gallons per mile. It's just that the engine and the engineers haven't set it to do so. I mean, there are actual vehicles that they have quite literally pulled off the market because they were too efficient or they were built too well. And that's a fact. There were guys that were running electric cars that were put out by, I think it was General Electric that put out a car. And there were people that, because of the way that the cars, they were basically... They let them use them. And then...
They've got a car that runs off of thorium.
Under the contract, anytime the company wanted for them, all they had to do was ask for them back and they would get them back. Well, these people love this car so much and it was so incredibly efficient and the company decided they wanted them back. Do you know what they did with all those cars? They destroyed them. Every one of those cars, they destroyed. Wasn't nothing wrong with the car.
Same thing.
Huh?
Each one. Electric Vehicle 1. EV1. Yep.
They destroyed them. Because somebody out there realized the potential.
They let people run them for a year. And they even had where you park at the airport and you just plug in. All electric.
Not to mention this. Imagine the power goes out of your house and you just plug into your car. You got a mobile generator. Anywhere you go, you got power.
Yeah, they had these little carports with solar panels up on top. And all you did was plug in the wand. Now, there's no metal on the outside. It was nothing but a coil that would go in between two other coils, and it would charge by mutual induction.
If that car is powerful enough to pull you and all your people down the road for hundreds of miles before it has to be recharged, then it has enough torque to turn any generator head on the market.
You know, they only had 100-mile range on them at first. Now they got them things up to 300 miles range.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, the whole thing is the technology available to meet maximum efficiency right now is already on the table, and it has been for a long time. Now, we got to get past the mindset as we, the people, of having to ask, the man for permission to become efficient. They're the ones telling you that there's a global warming, climate change, climate disruption, and they're the ones stealing tax money out of your pockets in order to fight this so-called problem when in reality everyone who's trying to get off the power grid are meeting resistance from their own local communities and governments, because if they ain't paying the electric company, then somebody's not getting the tax money off of it, and that's the whole deal. And it ain't that your wind turbine's unsightly, it's that somebody else wants the contract for it, so they don't want you putting up this one, they want you to buy theirs and then put that one up. And they want to fine you for putting your solar panels up. Well, so if you're talking out of one side of your neck while saying something out of your face to the public, and your actions aren't matching what your voice is saying, then something's wrong there. If we have an energy crisis and we gotta have to fight with the government just to become efficient, and then you got a guy like this that did this Conan seg, and he shows you incredible efficiency, incredible speed, incredible beauty. I mean, the engineering that went into that car is impeccable. And even that can be improved on. And he makes improvements all the time. This car gets better and better as he goes.
I'm going to have to buy me two or three of those.
Man, I would love to have even one of them. You know, that's a dream car right there. But basically...
according to the Bible, it says wherever you put your foot,
huh?
Becomes your... You know, so I guess just pray, man.
Yeah.
And you put your one. You got to find one and put your feet in it. That's it. And claim it.
Well... my aspirations in life are pretty simple. I want people to, you know, have an opportunity to live in comfort. I want people that they say are in third world countries. There shouldn't be no terminology like third world countries. Everybody should be in a first world country. And when we got technology like we have today, and then there's somebody out there that can't even get a fresh glass of water to drink, you know, we got a problem as society. That's why the Mad Science Show exists. That's why the Knights of the Round Table exist. Because there are these issues out there. And we're sitting here trying to point out technology and science that's real proven stuff. There ain't nothing crazy about what we've been saying. The fact that you could get hundreds of miles per gallon if you used it efficiently, it's been proven. There's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Yeah.
And running cars on water. It was done in the 70s. They still run vehicles on hydrogen technology. They just don't take it to the extreme of what it could actually be if allowed to do so. But because somebody needs your tax money, because somebody needs control, or this corporation's large and they want to buy out and suppress whatever information they can so that they can sell their product first, you don't sell the iPhone 6 until you got rid of all the iPhone 5s. You see what I mean? That's
yep.
what they're doing to you. And in the process, somebody in this world out there can't even get a fresh glass of water to drink. Somebody's sweating. Somebody's getting cold. You know, they got homeless people out there. We got more resources than we could ever use in a trillion, trillion lifetimes. And for those ridiculous people out there saying that this world's overpopulated, you know what? Yeah, you ain't volunteering your services to help the planet, so... You know, don't even talk about overpopulation. And if you don't understand...
They pump all their doggone toxins into our water system, and what doesn't have the toxins in it, they back their trucks up and suck it all up. Even if the town has water restrictions, they'll suck the doggone lake dry and then sell it to you and put it in bottles.
Yeah.
That float like balloons. It only takes 5 raindrops to float one. It goes out there and winds up in between 2 continents. What big figure eight of plastic island out there?
When an oil man named T. Boone Pickett moves his resource money into water as opposed to oil, which is his mainstay of making money to begin with, now they're calling water the blue gold, the next deal.
Yeah, and he takes it down to the coast, puts it on barges, and sends it over to Japan and China.
Yeah, the doggone Earth is 3/4 covered in water, folks. Over 3/4 covered in water. Not to mention all the ice that surrounds whatever. Look, you ain't never going to run out of water. And for somebody to sell you a bottle of water for $1 a bottle, they're probably the smartest salesman in the world. That's like selling you the air that you breathe. And believe me, if they got a chance to put a meter on your face for every breath you take, you got to pay, they'll do it.
Yeah, they already do, and they catch you for your methane too.
Yeah,
you're a farmer. They count your cows, and they got a methane tax. Oh my goodness, man! Come on.
Yep. Well, folks,
You know what? Here's the pisser of the thing. Excuse the terminology, but yeah, this methane tax, you're going to give them money. Now, what are they doing with that money to clean our air up? They ain't doing a doggone thing with it, except sticking it in their pocket for a Florida fund.
You know what? If they took that money, the carbon tax, which I 150,000% despise and disagree with, but if they took that money and they put it in hands of people like you and me to do research like what we're talking about, then I wouldn't be so upset about it. If they put it in the hands of researchers that were there to resolve the so-called issue, I wouldn't be worried about it. But this doesn't go into
the... Look, the more carbon dioxide in the air, the more the trees grow, which makes more oxygen.
Sure.
It absorbs it and takes care of it. The planet takes care of itself. But and when we got too much, we have lightning arcs that make ozone to actually... combat the global warming. We have lightning at stake. That the planet does it naturally.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing.
And if there's change for the good, they're going to sit there and say we did it.
Once,
no, you didn't.
Once the doggone electric car is built, there is no carbon emissions, and so they should be perfecting that. They should be perfecting the manufacturing process. So even in the manufacturing process, there's no carbon emissions. We have all the technology available to resolve every single problem that they can come up with, and then some.
Hey, look, in the days of Nikola Tesla, all the delivery vehicles were electric. And Nikola Tesla had an electric car that just sat there and pulled it out of the air from his Tesla coil, and it did 90 kilometers per hour. And he took a long trip. Way the heck out, you know, to other towns, way the heck out there. It took an all-day trip and turned around and came back.
Well, like I said, the technology's there. It's ready when the people decide they want to do something about it. But I have to put a word of warning out there to everybody listening in on this radio show. There's a clock ticking, and it's not a clock that's going to be the doomsday clock for the planet. It's a clock that's going to be the doomsday clock for the time in which you actually have a chance to utilize this technology, because once they get control of everything under the sun, including the sun, that also includes information. And so this information we're talking about may be one, at some point in time, considered forbidden knowledge. It's illegal to talk about free energy, because we proved that years ago that that's a myth, and that's not possible. And just like hate crimes for speech, you know, you can't say certain things, otherwise you're thrown in jail for what you just said, when what you said wasn't illegal to begin with, and it was probably based on common sense or observation of something that you witnessed that happened. But nonetheless, when you can't talk about it, when you can't utilize the information, the only ones who can use technology are a certain amount of people who are using that technology to oppress you, the people, who outnumber them 1 billion to 1. And when the people of this world want to utilize this technology and want to actually go for what we're talking about, free energy, freedom, and making sure that everybody else out here on this this planet is cared for, then that's when we'll gather together, and that's when we'll do things like what we're doing right now. Right now, we're on the we're like Paul Revere's Muddy. We're sitting here shouting out the British are coming, you know, even though the British are already here. Hi, British.
The cooks are here. The cooks are here.
Yeah, well, whatever. You know, we're trying to tell everybody they're coming.
We pay them to govern us, and they restrict us.
Yeah, they're coming to get this information. They're coming to shut people like me down, not be able to say what I'm saying. They're trying to debunk us. They send the trolls out, their paid shoes or whatever, to tell us how stupid we are and get us frustrated. Because I'm only human. I can only be told I'm stupid so many times before I get a reaction to it. I get either frustrated and want to throw my hands up in the air. But it's the average Joe. If the average Joe ain't going to share this information, then nobody's going to share this information.
They tell me I'm stupid. You know what? I take it as a compliment. That means that I've done something right that's got them torqued.
Yep.
I've gained enough attention. Yes, I must be doing something right. If they aren't fighting me, then I haven't done something right. That's all there is to it.
But. Yep. Well, Muddy, we got to go. We're at the end of the show, but before we...
I'll let
you have the last word. I got a life outside this. I can't sit around and beg and plead for the planet to reach common sense all 24/7. I wish I could, but I can't. I got things I got to do. I got experiments to do. I got things to put together so that I can make more videos. But either way, look, folks, all I'm asking for everybody out there listening in is to share this podcast. If you like this podcast, share it with somebody. If there's another network out there that wants to have me come on there and voice these things again, or Muddy, I'm sure Muddy wouldn't mind doing interviews with somebody. It's just ideas. And if you got ideas to match with our ideas or whatever, even new ideas, bring them to the table. That's what this radio show's all about. Bring them to the table. Share those ideas. But until you get this information into the hands of other people out there, I'm trying to tell everybody out there, what we're trying to explain to you is not rocket scientists. It's not rocket science. You can do this. And your neighbors can do this. And somewhere in your town, somebody knows how to weld. Somebody knows how to run a metal lathe or a milling machine. And you guys can take all these bits of knowledge, these little pieces of the puzzle, and put them together and shoot for the greatest efficiency in your communities. And when you get your community running so incredibly efficient, you can take those extra funds that would have otherwise went out to, you know, pay somebody else. You can put it back in your community to make even more advancements. And when your neighbors see this, they're going to want to join in. They're going to want to know what you did. They're going to want to share in that you know, way that you did that. That's what we're talking about. So, Muddy, you got any last words of common sense before we roll up out of here?
Well, we were talking about reinventing the wheel. That was the main deal here. And there's a thing to be a podcast. And somehow on a podcast, we can't take our most valued commenter of the Knights of the Round Table here, or Mad Science group here. We gotta let them know what Stephen Gibbons had here, which puts it all together.
Tell them about the resource link.
If you're going to remain grounded, maglev wheels are the future. But where we are going, Marty, we don't need Nova. That's right.
Yeah.
We don't need roads. Appreciate it, Stephen. Many, many good things to you and yours. It's been a pleasure to reunite with y'all and enjoy it. A lot of times I don't get to get here. Basically, the health's down and I'm working nights. And 90% of the time, I don't even make it home before the show unless I just catch the rest of it. But I do listen. I do listen on the cell phone on the way home and the end of what I'm doing. So... And if I'm not here in person with y'all, I'm here in spirit with y'all. I think y'all do a great job. Thank you so much for Shazoo, for all the things you've done, and same thing to Stephen Gibbons.
Thank you, man.
The rest of you that listen. Many good things to you and yours. God bless. And don't let anybody steal your energy.
Yep. And also on Stephen Gibbons, folks, if you jump over there to the superchat.html, right above the radio player, in the center of the page, is Stephen's resource page. He's got, he has link after link after link where he took his own personal time to come on there and put links to all kinds of researchers, all kinds of energy ideas. And so if you can't find nothing on that page, you ain't looking. But if you find something new that ain't on that page, send that over to him and let him throw it up there for you, whatever. Because that's what it's all about, sharing ideas. You know? And
yeah,
like we always say, we're not asking for anything else other than to spread the word, just to help everybody out with all this information. Stephen does a wonderful job. He's one of my favorite people to come in the chat room, because every subject that ever comes up, before you know it, you look down in there and there's a corresponding link to it. It shows you where you want to talk about a good researcher. If we can never get him on the radio with us live, that would be cool too. But hey, what are you doing?
They say the brain is like a muscle, and the more you flex it, the stronger it gets.
Yeah,
Stephen, you might be a big bubblehead with all the exercise you put on that brain. To tell you what, we can't get you to come on here and flap your gums, but you sure do tap them fingers on the keyboard well and do your research and share.
Yep.
So, many good things to you. As much as part of this show as I wish you'd be in with flapping your gums. So, good things. You're one of my favorites there. So I have to say hello to Patty Walking Turtle and Three Crow and Charles Two Dog, my gosh.
Oh yeah, they're more wonderful additions to what we're talking about, folks. That's what we do here.
Radio and any other radio systems that pick us up and rebroadcast us. Much love to each and every one of you. God bless.
To all the affiliated networks and People for People Radio, TCT Radio, and all the other people that take the time to rebroadcast and. If you like this podcast, put it on your network. Put it on somebody else's network. It don't matter. You take this information and take it wherever you can. Give it to anybody and his brother. Everybody and his brother. And then we can get some things done in this world. That's all we're asking for. Just pass the message along. Been listening to Mad Science Show. If you want to join us on the Knights of the Round Table, same time, same place tomorrow. And we'll talk about some more important issues and whatever we can get resolved then. So with that said, peace and love, everybody. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Ah, crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.